Steve Friedman.
Okay, well, let's
hey, Steve.
Go ahead and get started. If people would go ahead and take a seat, we do have, like I say, some places at the tables here with mics that we could pass back and forth for those that anticipate commenting or participating. Just by way of introduction, this is the second of public meetings, informal public meetings, to discuss proposed revisions to Rules 37 and 45. We had our first meeting October 2nd, in which we provided an overview of the initial draft of the rules, led by Freeman Kraft McGregor, who is the technical experts that we've retained. And then we did solicit written comments and questions from the public with a deadline of October 14th. We did receive a number of comments and questions, which we posted to the Internet. And our primary focus today, then, is to try to go over those written comments and questions, and also to leave some time towards the end for additional comments and questions. Before I go into introductions and some of the procedures that I think might be helpful for us to follow this morning, I'd like to ask Secretary Buescher if he has any general remarks he'd like to start off with.
Thank you, Bill. Very briefly, I want to thank everyone for coming today, and for those folks listening on the internet, thank everyone for their participation in this process. When we began, we decided to use an informal process before we start the formal rulemaking process so that we can get as much input as possible on this process. I must tell you, I am very pleased with the quality of the comments. A number of folks made the same comments, consistent comments, and that's useful because that's how we find out where there are problems or holes in the first draft that we've circulated. Everyone learned a lot from the process in 2007, and we are not recreating the 2007 process by any means. We are trying to do as transparent a process as possible. We have both a constitutional and a statutory duty, an obligation to comply with the rulemaking authority and obligation under the Constitution, but that was expanded by House Bill 1335 last year. And that really is much of the impetus for this rulemaking process. So we are attempting to fulfill our statutory and constitutional obligation to do it in the most open and transparent way possible. And I am just very appreciative of the both the quantity and the quality of the input and suggestions which we've received. And we're going to try to work through the comments in a workmanlike way, but we've got an awful lot of comments, and so time management is going to be somewhat of a challenge. But this is one step in a process that is going to take a couple of months. So I'm pleased, and with that, Bill, I'll turn it back to you.
Thank you, Secretary Buescher. Just some general remarks about kind of how I think we can work efficiently. There is a sign-up sheet on the table by the door. It would be helpful if people would sign up if they're going to participate in the discussion. There's also a spreadsheet that provides a summary list of the comments that we received. Hopefully everybody has that. I think a copy is on the table as well. We spent a fair amount of time at our previous meeting talking about sort of the purpose and our approach to this. I won't repeat all of that, but as you know, the Secretary of State's office has engaged the services of Freeman Kraft McGregor to help us draft the rules. They, you know, do have a great deal of background nationally working with federal election assistance, the Election Assistance Commission, NIST, with certification processes in various states. So especially since the new law, House Bill 1335, provides the opportunity for Colorado to utilize testing results from other jurisdictions, both the EAC and other states, we're really appreciative of having that expertise to help us as we try to make these adjustments in our own testing process. I do want to do introductions. Again, my name is Bill Hobbs, Deputy Secretary of State. I'm assuming we have Freeman Kraft McGregor on the line, but I better make sure before we go any further, if you guys would identify yourselves, if you're there.
Yes, this is Paul Kraft.
Morning, Paul.
This is Steve Freeman.
Steve.
And this is Kate McGregor.
Good morning, Kate.
Good morning.
And maybe just the other people at the table, if you'd like to introduce yourselves just for the record. Again, we're broadcasting on the Internet, and so it is important that people identify themselves. But go ahead, Judd.
I'm Judd Choate. I'm the director of the Division of Elections.
Stephanie Sigalski, Voting Equipment Certification Program Manager.
Bernie Buescher, Secretary of State.
And then also to my left, we have Monica Marquez, Deputy Attorney General, who represents the Secretary of State. So welcome, Monica. And maybe, I don't know whether we can do some of the microphones or not, but for the benefit of Freeman Kraft McGregor, if we could maybe share the microphones and have people that are at the table introduce themselves as well. Sheila, would you like to start?
Sure. Sheila Reiner, Mesa County.
Josh Liss, Jefferson County.
Pam Anderson, Jefferson County.
Bob Mowell, candidate for El Paso County.
Al Kolwitz, Colorado Voter Group.
Harvey Branscombe from Eagle County and the Colorado Voter Group.
Jenny Flanagan, Colorado Common Cause.
Thank you. There are some limitations that I want to point out. We obviously have limitations on the mics. We're stretching them a bit. Hopefully we won't get feedback. We've had a problem in this room sometimes with feedback. So far things sound pretty good, but hopefully our luck will hold. I think one thing that I want to stress is that with our the fact that we have remote listeners, it's going to be really important that we proceed in an orderly way where I either recognize people who want to speak or people identify themselves. I'd also suggest that we try to focus on the most important stuff. A lot of the comments were really good about pointing out, you know, the typographical errors, misspellings, and things like that. That's really, really helpful, but we probably won't need discussion about that. The spreadsheet, I think, has about 100 comments that we have. We'd like to take the first couple of hours going through those and focusing on those. So that means going pretty quick. Probably. So I suggest that we focus on the big stuff and have our discussion about about those things. As we will sort of go through it rule by rule and comment by comment. I think Stephanie will probably have comments about some of them. I think Freeman Kraft McGregor is prepared to respond to some of the comments and questions, and then we'll go through that and I'm hopeful then that we can get through that in a couple of hours and then allow about 45 minutes towards the end for any general comments and questions, perhaps from people that did not submit written comments to us, you know, that they're not on the spreadsheet. We want to cover those as well. I think that's it. Does everybody have the spreadsheet? That's going to be sort of my list that I'm going to go through basically rule by rule, and we'll be sort of be focusing on rule numbers. Stephanie has put the rules on the screen, but I think everybody has a copy. It's not really necessary to see that. And I think what I'll do then is just start with the very first one, rule 45. Mr. Kolwitz?
point of order kind of questions. First is, I don't recognize any Colorado voter group items on here. Were those incorporated in some way?
I'm sorry, could you say that again?
The Colorado voter group submitted on October 14th a document, and that's posted on your website, but I don't see anything identified from Colorado voter group on this list of items to be considered.
I think what we were focusing on was the specific comments on individual rules, and I don't know if you didn't have any, then they're probably not listed on the spreadsheet. Is that correct, Stephanie? Yeah,
there were very definitely. And then secondly, as a point of order, well, first of all, thank you for answering my question that these rules, this submission is not incorporated in the list of items to be considered.
We do have the submission, and I think it's posted on the website.
And secondly, the procedure that you've outlined here makes no provision for missing information. And I wonder, at what point does that come into play?
I think perhaps I'd suggest towards the end. You know, again, we'll go through the rules as listed, and then what we haven't covered. You know, if you're saying you'd like to suggest additional rules, I think that'd be fine. Again, we're just focusing on coming up with a draft for formal rulemaking, a draft revisions to those two rules, 37 and 45.
So basically, we're aiming at correcting the things that are on this list as our principal goal.
For purposes of proposing amendments to rules 37 and 45.
Okay, yes. Thank you very much.
But if something's not on the list, that certainly doesn't foreclose adding more things to it. The first one is rule 45.1.1. Stephanie, you've summarized the comments.
Sure. The comment was the definition of an audio ballot should be changed to the EAC definition. I'm going to let Freeman Kraft McGregor answer this one or address it.
Okay. This is Paul Kraft. The language that's being critiqued there is basically language from the original rule, which seemed to us to be sufficient for its purpose. Looking back at the 2002 voting system standards, there really is not a definition of audio ballot. If you go to the 2005 VVSG standards, they've got a definition that's contingent on the definition of the ballot, and they also rely on other definitions. So unless we pick up a substantial amount of their definitions, which may not be a bad idea, you know, the definition that we've got seems to work. The Colorado definition, as we've got it, includes in the definition the ability of the voter to vote that ballot, where the EAC definition seems to be limited to just the audio presentation of the ballot to the voter.
I think this was a comment from Hart InterCivic. I don't think we have anyone here. Is there any additional comment on that comment? If not, then I'll move on to the next one. 45.1.12, Stephanie?
Sure. This one is from Common Cause, stating, and Jenny, I want some actual clarification on this one. Your comment indicated that there's, the way that the rule is written, there's a possibility that other locations may be included as to where ballots can be cast. And I'm a little bit confused because it seemed like in the rule we actually limited that. We took out the et cetera and limited it down to specific locations. So it's this one.
Right, and this is Jenny. Just because it says includes but not limited, I didn't know if there was a vision or a possibility of other locations that. And I know that we've sort of introduced vote centers. Maybe there's another concept we haven't yet identified. I wasn't sure what the thinking was there.
Okay.
If there were other locations, and maybe there's not.
Okay.
Just clarifying.
Paul?
Okay, this is Paul. Basically, the definition in Rule 45 of vote centers is as to vote centers and their functions within voting systems and the standards. We don't see Rule 45 as setting any standards for polling and voting locations. So, you know, the change there of not limited to was basically just intended to avoid any technical glitch where, you know, some kind of new voting center comes along that's not incorporated into the existing definition for that function. So,
Jenny, would you, you're okay with that? I mean, we, if you're more comfortable suggesting taking that out, just so that it's an exclusive list, but.
I think it's okay if, I mean, it's my understanding if there were to be another kind of location, one, it would have to be designated by the election official and would probably be addressed elsewhere in the rules.
Okay. All right. Thank you. The next one is 45.1.14. Stephanie?
Sure. We received two comments on this, one from Harvey Branscombe and one from Common Cause, regarding the definition of Secretary of State and the use of his or her designee, and there was some concern over that, and I can appreciate that concern. I think, you know, the rule states that this definition is for Rule 45 only, which by using the his or her designee in the rule, it prevents the secretary from having to do the actual testing. No decision-making occurs in Rule 45. Tests are conducted, and that is documented. Title I, sorry, I am the worst person with feedback in the office, apparently. Title I grants the authority to the secretary to actually make the certification decision. He cannot designate that out. So he is the one who makes the determination whether or not substantial compliance needs to be taken into effect on the testing. So, but I will, but we will look at it as a whole throughout the rule to make sure that we aren't delegating some sort of authority that shouldn't be delegated. Paul, do you have any follow-up on that?
Well, yeah, I think the secretary is, on a day-to-day operational basis, going to make decisions and make delegations, and I don't know that there's any real public policy advantage to restricting his powers of delegation within the certification rule. I think that's one of those decisions that should be outside this rule. And he may make those decisions based on availability of resources from case to case. So, our intent was basically to set it up so that he could delegate as necessary. And these people are his designees, so they can't do anything without his designation or delegation to them.
Harvey?
Thank you. Harvey Branscombe speaking. It seems to me that at a minimum there should be a paper trail to allow a trail of accountability for the public so that it's possible for the public to know who was designated for any given point in time for any specified purpose. And that might suffice to satisfy my objection to this particular problem. The fact that the Secretary of State can operate verbally designating someone and the words substantial compliance do occur in Rule 45, by the way. So I am concerned about that issue, particularly about the definition of substantial compliance, but also the whole range of possible, if a common layperson reads the rule, they'll see the word Secretary of State there, and that generally means the Secretary of State. Now, you'd have to have read this definition and realized that it could be anybody, including a volunteer working at the Secretary of State's office or even not, might have been designated even potentially haphazardly from the public's point of view, and it would be much better if there were a trail of accountability, such as a paper record showing who was designated for what purpose in regarding Rule 45.
I think, Harvey, I probably have a little bit different perspective, but let me sort of compare and contrast. I mean, I appreciate the concern that if there's a delegation, a formal delegation of authority, what I think I'm hearing is that there ought to be some documentation, accountability, and so forth. But I'm not looking at the way I'm understanding this. That's not what I think this is doing. I think we're sort of used to seeing, certainly in the Secretary of State's context, throughout the election code, lots of references to the Secretary of State, who shall do this, or you'll file this with the Secretary of State. And I think most generally people are used to knowing that that doesn't mean the Secretary of State personally, that we as employees of the Secretary of State's office are agents of the Secretary of State. We carry out those duties according to our job descriptions or whatever. And so wherever the statutes or the rules refer to Secretary of State, it is not intended to require the Secretary of State to personally do every one of those things. And I think, to me, this definition is simply recognizing that there may not be personal performance by Secretary Buescher, but only that wherever that we're referring to the Secretary, it's whoever is authorized in the normal course of their duties to carry out those duties, as opposed to delegating decision-making authority. There's no way to delegate in the rule the Secretary, for example, the Secretary's ultimate decision whether to certify or not. And I don't think that's what's intended here, but just simply to say that we don't have to, through every reference to the rule where it says, the Secretary of State shall conduct a public demonstration or something. That means the Secretary of State personally, or we have to say the Secretary of State or his employees. And that gets redundant to keep saying or employees or agents, is the way I look at it. Mr. Colwitz.
Yes, thank you. We have noticed that the language has gotten distorted, and the Department of State, the Colorado Department of State, which is the entity I think we're talking about, has become commonly known as the Secretary of State. And it would be helpful to re-engineer the vocabulary to refer it back to the Department of State when it is that we mean the Department of State, and reserve the term Secretary of State when we're referring to the Secretary of State.
When you're saying when only say Secretary of State, when you mean personally that one individual?
Yes.
I mean, I think the problem with that is, and I think your point's well taken, there, we do talk about Department of State, and we do talk about Secretary of State, but and the Secretary of State's office, and maybe we do need to look at the terminology, but throughout the election code there are references to the Secretary of State that I don't think are intended to mean.
I understand that it's been an evolutionary, you know, but it leads to confusion in our part when we read things.
Okay.
This is Bernie Buescher. Actually, I don't think it is evolutionary. I think it is constitutional. The history is that the Constitution created certain constitutional offices, and the statutes, and I suspect this is true whether you look at the Attorney General, the Secretary of State, or the Treasurer's office, refer to that office as the department. Now, I suspect the legislature could go in and change that, but that is that's the statutory scheme, and I think that's the constitutional scheme. Our counsel may wish to comment on that, but as long as I have followed this world, that has always been the use for those three positions, and I suspect also for the governor's office.
Yes, those statewide elected offices are established by Constitution and further defined in the statute in Title 24.
Jenny, I think you had also had a comment about that as well. Do you have anything to add?
I'm sort of more in the, if, just for clarity's sake, I think if we're going, I think the documentation of who is designated to take on a certain task, some of the requirements within the certification process are not as simple as just putting the hearing together, but determining whether or not the recommendation for compliance is going to be made. So there are some technical requirements. So if it's a contractor or a certain staff member, just, I think as Harvard was talking about, having some sort of paper trail or accountability so we know who signs that document, who was responsible for that recommendation or that part of the process, just so that it's clear.
Okay. Thank you. Okay, well, to take that, those comments, thank you. The next one is 45.1.17. Stephanie?
Sure. This was another one submitted by Mr. Branscombe, changing the definition of test log, test record, and test report. It was actually a lengthy comment with some requirements on this office and defining that, as well as mandating that this office use a searchable format. I'm going to go ahead and let Freeman Kraft McGregor address this first. Paul?
Okay. Basically, as I understand the line item here, Stephanie, Mr. Branscombe has asked that, you know, all the PDF documents which would be produced online be in a searchable format. If that is your intention, I think the problem, as Stephanie has pointed out in the spreadsheet, is what do you do when you can't? If you get a printout from the voting system that needs to be introduced into evidence in the test record, and you scan it on a scanner in a PDF but not in a searchable format, you know, what do you do? You don't necessarily have a print driver feeding to a PDF there that's going to give you a searchable document in every case. So I think probably making this to the extent possible, it certainly makes it easier to review documents for third parties to come in and review them and search for key phrases. And that's a good practice where it's possible. I guess I don't think you can require it for all documents.
Harvey?
Yes, and I would agree with that. I think it's not possible to require it for all documents, particularly if the documents are coming from external sources. I'd like to see an intention stated and a best efforts phrase in this for the purpose of Colorado's activities. Also, however, my note also includes three phrases: test log, test record, and test report. And those are three different alternate phrases used in Rule 45, which refer to what I believe is the same thing. And I think they should all be tied in here. Or the references to test report and test record should be replaced with test log, so that they all tie into this definition.
Thank you.
Okay, I'm not sure if we're going to be jumping to another comment here following up on that, Stephanie, but one of our comments in our original draft on test records and test logs and all that was that this becomes a policy issue of basically getting some input from stakeholders and interested parties as to what real content they would like to see within the test record. We've suggested a format, which I'm not on that part of my work papers, but in the rule we tried to suggest a test record which would not be as voluminous as, you know, the test records that were kept in 2007, something that would be a little easier for the interested person to come in and review and figure out what happened. And that record would include, of course, the requirements matrix. It would include a test plan based on the requirements matrix. It would include a test report, and it would include notes that were taken as you went through the testing process. You know, and pretty much everything, every requirement that's shown in the requirement matrix, you should be able to trace that out to, okay, you know, what happened during that test, who conducted it, what were the results, did it pass or fail, and how do you know? And I think within the documents we suggested that can be accomplished. Now, it's really up to the department and the citizens of Colorado, you know, what they really want these documents to be. I think in the prior certification effort, there was an effort to make anything anyone could possibly ever look at available, and you had quite a bit of stuff that you had to look at just to get a picture of what had happened in the certification test.
Al?
I have 3 points. First, to achieve the kind of test work product that we're interested in seeing happen, the test planning, test results, notes, etc., have to be electronic by design. The process that was used in the past, they were manual by design. They were handwritten. There was nothing typed. So that resulted in non-scannable documents, obviously. Everything was written. It's like somebody jumped back into 1930. And we're asking that at least by design, the test plans and reports and documentation and notes be electronic.
Understood, so that it's Secondly, electronically searchable.
The test documentation included vast amount of redaction. This caused the documents to be not searchable. And we have requested and pleaded that confidential information not be permitted into the test room. There is no reason for it.
I think that's a different comment. I don't know.
I understand, but the redaction should be not allowed.
Okay, and your third comment?
Now, the third comment actually has, it deals with the court testimony and the statement by Judge Manzanares.
And it's on this rule. You're talking about this
yes,
rule.
Yes, specifically about this okay. rule. The judge said he agreed with the plaintiffs that measured by any scientific method, the Secretary of State has done an abysmal job of documenting their tests or logging their procedures and their tests. I say that not to insult the department, but to say that in a court of law, it was recognized that we are dealing with...
Well, that
with
was before the 2007
I understand.
Certification.
I understand.
So what we're trying to do here is draft
and I,
rules.
He goes on to say that he would like to see the test logs and documents done in such a way that would allow others to replicate the test. That's the phrase I'm reaching for. And that's the phrase that I'm accustomed to as a professional in the testing world.
Your suggestion is language that requires enough detail so that others know how to replicate
independently,
the test.
Not write, but re-execute precisely the
Understood.
Same test to get precisely the same result.
Right, and just echoing that, I agree with Al. I had also raised my hand on the same point because the. Actually, Freeman, Kraft, and McGregor have recommended removing the language that says that the test record, the test log, should be sufficient to reproduce the test. And I think that language is important. And even if there are cases where it's unachievable because it's a very, very bad situation to get into where you are looking at documentation and you can't reproduce the test. That really is the criterion for an effective piece of documentation. So I strongly recommend to go with that original language.
Well, if Freeman Kraft McGregor may comment.
Go ahead.
Al and Harvey, our intention in changing that language was not to remove the ability to validate a test or independently recreate a test. The original language and the original rule, as we read it, didn't really call for that. And once again, part of the intention that we have in the test documents that we're requiring, the requirements matrix, a detailed test plan, and an account of what happened when that plan was executed with the output documents, with tester notes on deviations as to why they occurred and all of that. That, we think, at least from our perspective, is sufficient for an independent tester, and someone who's got sufficient knowledge to do the independent testing, but for them to come by and validate the results of the testing that was done in the first place by reproducing and recreating the test according to the same plan. More importantly, I think, is it gives third parties like you the information you need to see if you actually think that the test plan that was done competently. When I'm looking at someone else's work product and deciding if I want to rely on it, you know, to support something that I'm working on, I'm more interested in what they did, how they did it, and why, than I am going back and necessarily recreating the test. I'll go back and recreate the test if, you know, kind of as a last resort. More than likely, though, if I'm looking at a deficient work product, I'm going to be able to decide that I'm not going to rely on that and not going to accept it based on, you know, the report that's written and the documentation supporting that report.
Okay, thank you.
So, I mean, it comes back down to, I think we're all trying to get to the same thing, and I guess what I would suggest is that, you know, if you come to understand the documents that we're suggesting make up the test record, tell us what else specifically needs to be in that test record to give you the comfort level that you want.
One of the measurements that I would use is the standard by which the test is measured. Not the quality of the production of the test, but what is the test actually measuring? Because professionally, we all understand that a problem occurs when there's a deviation between what is expected and what is actual. And if you don't have a requirement that that expected be documented totally in a way that is unambiguously understood, you don't have a chance. And the test matrix approach that's being proposed skims the surface of the globe and doesn't address the kind of requirement that we're needing to be addressed.
Harvey.
All right. Yes, I'm sympathetic with what Paul Kraft is saying on two counts. One is what he's saying about that's exactly what we want. We want to be able to know whether the test was correctly designed, successfully executed, and that the actual the test was passed or failed. And the rule needs to be able to provide enough specificity to ensure that we will get that kind of documentation. And I know Paul is saying those words, but it's not. I don't read it in the rule the way the rule is written. And secondly, on the 2007 certification, the fact that there was a huge amount of documentation which wasn't very effective is a problem. And I recognize that too much ineffective documentation doesn't make up for sufficient less effective documentation. And we do need effective documentation. So,
okay, thank you.
Okay, well, I guess to come back one more time, Harvey, and now, because I think, once again, we're on the same page. Our concept of the requirement matrix and the test plan and the work papers and ultimately a report on the system is to do that in a professional manner so that, okay, you can see the list of requirements. Both the requirements that are in the 2002 voting system standards and the Colorado-specific requirements. And we would hope that, you know, that is enough of a standard that fairly quickly it is both correct and everybody has some confidence that it is correct. And then for each of those requirements, you should be able to see, you know, basically it's a requirements traceability matrix, and you should be able to trace that requirement into the test plan, how it was to be tested, and the records of the test being conducted, and a report basically summarizing what it means. And, yeah, I'm not sure that I quite see where the problem is, other than perhaps that we haven't been able to sit down with those documents and work through it where everybody understands how they work. And, of course, the important thing for this rule is to be able to specify how they work.
Harvey?
Possibly the default lies in the use of the word may include in this rule. That's my response.
I do want to keep us moving because we're about 25% of the way through our time and still in the first third of the first page out of four. So this is important. I realize that some of these items are really important, so I'm hoping that we'll move faster through some of these. But I do want to make sure we don't spend too much time on any one item. And okay. One thing I might encourage, it occurs to me now that as we talk about these things and people share their different points of view, people might come up with better language, just like Harvey was referring to about maybe the difficulty with the may include language or whatever. So we will continue to be open to additional language, either before we issue a formal notice of rulemaking, or that people, if once we do the formal notice of rulemaking, people are always welcome to bring in suggested revisions to the rules as well. So that's what I hope is part of the value of this discussion, is that we'll all sort of realize better language to achieve our objectives. Let me go on to the next one, 45.1.18. Stephanie.
Okay. We received two comments on this one. One was actually Mr. Branscombe suggested new language. And the second comment was just removing the phrase "or his or her agent" in light of the Secretary of State definition. That one's pretty straightforward. I would like to take a look at, and maybe actually the approach here would be if Harvey could explain some of what he was getting at with his new definition of the trusted build.
Harvey?
Okay, thank you. The first case, I've actually indicated the need for a specific delegation by the Secretary of State if being used in writing in order to be able to understand the audit trail for the trusted build. I've also conformed software and firmware and all those. I guess that's in the original change. And there is a concern about the tracing, being able to trace to the original source code. I think it's important that be a piece of the trusted build definition. It's also important, given the actual history that we've had in the past election, to understand that trusted build needs to incorporate all of the software and firmware running on the system, and not to exclude portions that might have been considered commercial off the shelf or so, or at least if there's going to be a write out or a call out for commercial off the shelf, it's got to be very carefully proscribed in order to prevent device drivers and such from interfering with the definition or falling outside the definition of trusted build, where in fact they may have a drastic effect on the operation of the system.
Paul, any comment?
I've got a brief comment, and then I think Steve may have more. They had one problem that we have here that I realized after we got the draft done is you've actually got two different meanings of trusted build in Colorado, or perhaps three. One is the trusted build of the system coming in to test, and that will be the trusted build that actually is, traceable back to the source code and source code analysis. And, that trust is going to come from whoever verified that, in fact, that trusted build was created from that source code. That is the first trusted build that we have to deal with, the one that we bring into the test environment and we load on the equipment so that we know the stuff we're testing is the stuff that we're supposed to be testing. The second version of the trusted build is a trusted build that you have of the system after you've completed testing, which Colorado is then going to adopt. And in Colorado's case, yes, it does include all of the COTS elements, the operating system, everything that it takes to run the system. And yes, having those drivers be known entities, having all the COTS elements be known entities, is important and is part of that trusted build. The third trusted build is, from what I understand of your prior process post-certification, is the trusted build that's actually created for each different computer platform that it's going to run on and taken out by the state and installed in the counties. So I think maybe part of the problem is we're talking about those three different items within one definition of trusted build, and I think that needs to be addressed.
So that some more work on the definition there would be appropriate, I think. So, Al?
Yes.
When considering the revisions to the definition, I don't know if the points I'm going to make belong under the words trusted build or whether they require additional words, different definition. But the process of verifying that a particular voting system conforms to the trusted build, that process needs to be rigorously defined. And I don't know if I need to say more.
Installation of the trusted
build? Not just the business about putting this disk into this drawer and running it through this computer, but it must verify that all elements of the system, including the non-election parts of the system, as Harvey mentioned, are conforming to what is required to run this. Boulder County, as you're well aware, had a major problem with this in the November 2008 election, which basically caused them to manually process every single ballot. And the second part of this process is that the installation of the master disk has to be observable by the public. That should be included in the process. And I'm not going to make a whole list of what ought to be there.
Right, and we're on the definition of trusted build right now.
That's what I'm talking about. We refer to trusted build in a broad, generic way, but this definition is working it into a disk. And I'm afraid that the language will continue to be used as though trusted build meant everything dealing with it, including the process. So maybe a different term is required. I'm not sure.
Okay.
Yeah, and also, Al, what you're talking about is a detailed process for system installation, system validation, system auditing, which those activities are really outside of Rule 45. Rule 45 in the certification process needs to provide good, solid benchmarks, and those benchmarks ultimately are part of the product of the certification program. Those benchmarks, including the trusted bill, should be adequate to support all those other areas. But I'm not sure we want to bring the process of installing and auditing systems in the counties into Rule 45. I think that belongs elsewhere in the election code and rules. And also, Steve was the primary reviewer of Mr. Bascom's comments. So, Steve, have you got any thing to add on this trusted bill piece here?
Well, I don't have anything to add in particular for Mr. Bascom, but I do want to add that we have dealt for a long time in this issue, this particular issue that's being talked about, in terms of the introduction of changes through the third-party operation system and everything else. And that problem is far more difficult than it sounds on the surface, because as Windows and other operating systems involved, we run into the situation that some of those identifying and some of those changes are difficult to capture. The trusted build goes ahead and is part of the process of doing that and is usually accompanied, or at least we should be requesting or expecting the accompaniment of a electronic signatures to identify the appropriate files as we go through to match against. The problem comes up on those is Microsoft and some of the other third-party vendors that are involved in some of these packages have been adopting practices where some of those electronic signatures are not stable. This is a technical problem that we're going to have to deal with, and it's going to be continuing to advance. The rule's never probably going to catch up with this. So this is probably going to have to be done and treated within the actual test development, test planning procedures and process, in particular in terms of capturing the information necessary for the validation of the system that's being certified.
One last comment, Harvey.
Thank you. I'm a little concerned to hear Paul talking about three trusted builds. It's clear that the so-called build that's being input into the test isn't trusted, and until it has actually been passed through a certification test, there might be modifications in the course of the certification test the vendor would make in order to pass the certification test. Perhaps that should be called the provisional or the proposed trusted build. And I realize that the BAC is involved in that to some degree. But also I'm concerned to at least to note the fact that the commercial off-the-shelf portions are being tested, presumably by the certification process, even if they're not being specifically separately tested. They're certainly being tested as part of the system, and therefore they can well be included within the definition of trusted build from the perspective of what actually goes on the system in the election. And I recognize you're talking about potential conditional compiles for different devices, perhaps. Preferably, those conditional compiles have passed through the certification test somehow. So my feeling is that those, besides the fact that the input build isn't trusted yet, and you wouldn't call it a trusted build, the other two seems to me that those don't separate out as to definition, or shouldn't.
Well, if we are using EAC work product, we are going to be looking at getting a disk from them that they call the trusted build. So, and the trust there is trusting that, in fact, this particular build of the system, you know, came from the source code that was reviewed. So, I don't know if we want to create additional confusion by renaming that the provisional or candidate build or whatever. But, yeah, I agree that we need to expand these definitions on trusted build so that at each point prior to testing, after something's been satisfactorily tested, and when something is being installed in the counties, for each of those three things, we know exactly what we're talking about. Our definition.
That sounds like an approved.
So that everybody understands what we're talking about.
An approved Colorado trusted build might be the definition we're talking about here. We don't need to redefine what the EAC defines as trusted build, obviously, in our own rules here. That whatever they define it as is what they define it as.
Okay, sounds like there's going to be some changes, and we can come back to that. Let me move
on.
Al, we're going to need to move on.
But he's made a point that it's not correct, and I think it's important so that he doesn't come back with a rule that's incomplete.
Okay, Al.
And the point is that the requirements are that the Rule 45 has to address all of the elements and controls required to successfully conduct an election on a voting system. That very specifically does not, as Mr. Kraft has suggested, exclude the process that we're talking about.
Okay, let's move on to the next group. Mm-hmm. I think we can take a series here. Harvey suggested some new rules, I think, point 19, point 20, point 21, point 22, and point 23. Stephanie?
Yeah, I'm going to take one just slightly out of order, and then I'm going to let Harvey discuss why he'd like these included. I can guess on one of them being appropriate engineering standards. And that's actually, while the comment is here at the beginning of the rule, it's a comment we received later in the role several times. And I know Jenny was one of those people that made a comment on it, because it's not defined. And it's a struggle to define it. That's how it's written in House Bill 1335. There were a lot of discussions during the drafting of House Bill 1335 as to what that meant. And I'll be frank, we didn't really know at the time what that meant. It was kind of this this goal to reach of deciding what that is. So I recognize that we need to address appropriate engineering standards. That was just the language that was lifted from House Bill 1335. So, Harvey, if you want to go ahead and address kind of the successful conduct, ballot, operating correctly, and election day results.
Right. I think they fall in two categories. There's the category of the potentially circular definition, where Rule 45 is presumably helping to provide the framework for what constitutes a, you know, it conceivably could actually tell us what constitutes appropriate engineering standards. It certainly should be helping to guide us on what means successful conduct or operating correctly. It concerns me to see those phrases used in the rule, and of course they're used later down in the rule. There maybe that's the place to discuss these particular topics. But in general, there are these sets of phrases that we need to watch out for, because they leave an open door to anybody's idea of what that means. And I think if there is such an opening, there needs to be a process for accounting for how that decision was made, at a minimum. If we can't put the definition, we may well not be able to put the definition here, but we need to have a way for the public to look in to see, well, here's the person or the group that made that decision and how they made it about what constitutes operating correctly. But I would, of course, advise that to the extent possible that we try to use more specific words where these I just called out, where the fact that these words are used later on in the text and that they aren't defined, and they really ought to be replaced with other words that are more specific. As for election day results, I think that's a very specific one that comes up, and I've forgotten the context of it already. I'd have to search here to check it, but we'll see it when we get to it, that this doesn't necessarily make sense, election day results, when you're talking about a mail ballot election. I mean, there are problems here with the language sometimes that we need to watch out for because of the way elections are evolving. Likewise, I think it's helpful to define ballot, because ballot is used in a very specific way in the document, but it actually has a broader meaning, and it's important to cover the paper ballot and the role that comes out of a DRE at present in the context of what a ballot is. So I've provided language for ballot. I didn't provide language for the other. I just pointed out that they need to be defined.
It's really helpful, Harvey, that you've provided language, and that gives us something to digest. I don't know that we need to discuss it further, but Freeman, Kraft, McGregor, do you have any comments?
Steve?
Yeah. I don't particularly disagree in general with anything that Harvey is saying. I think many of these do need further definitions. I do take a minor exception, but I think it's an important point on the ballot definition. His definition strongly places a requirement for a ballot that is a paper product. And in practice and usage, a ballot is also an abstract concept in terms of identifying that collection of contests, candidates, and issues that a voter is presented with. It may not necessarily be at certain phases a record copy of that decision. I think the more generic ballot needs to be kept, even though I acknowledge the fact that we probably need to include some consideration of the record forms that ballot may be applied to that. Note in particular that the extension in terms of that requirement may be a new requirement against this that has implications for the systems are being accepted. I believe Branscombe's note on the note 5 actually successfully addresses that issue to some extent about the issues and problems that need to be considered. But that's not particularly broad. That has to do with introducing new rules.
Mr. Secretary.
And I guess.
Mr. Secretary.
Okay.
Thank you. Bill, there is a statutory definition of ballot And I'm not sure of the extent to which we can change that definition. Something that I think the attorneys will have to look at.
Harvey?
And I would acknowledge that's a fact. That means that we should be very careful in using the word ballot in Rule 45 or provide another word or a distinguishing adjective on the word ballot in order to make it clear what it means. But it's not necessary for the Rule 45 language to conform but with this statute necessarily, but it certainly would be helpful that it would do so. So one might look at places where ballot occurs in Rule 45 and see whether we could be more usefully defining and not accidentally eliminating aspects of ballot. And I think it's an important point that there are electronic records of ballots potentially. Those really need to be distinguished when you're talking about that because it's very different from the paper implementation of ballot. And I prefer to make it clear about the physical record separate from the electronic record. In fact, we're having that very discussion in Aspen on a recent election right now.
Al?
I just want to amplify from the Aspen experience that there is an ambiguity between the ballot that is cast by the voter, which is what the statute talks about, and artifacts, for example, scanned images of the ballot. Okay. And that needs to be differentiated. Secondly, throughout the documentation and the rule, there is a looseness of use of the word counting ballots when the words counting votes is meant. And that has made its way actually into the reports that are produced by the vendors. So if you look at an election report, you'll see a count of the votes cast, okay?
Meaning, are you referring how many to the language ballots that Harvey has suggested here?
Well, I'm just amplifying the need to not only get a very good definition of ballot, but use it correctly throughout so that when you mean votes counted, that we don't say ballots counted.
Okay, thank you. Let me move on to the next one. Is 45.1.5. Bethany?
This is... Judge, you have to scroll up. For some reason, this one and the next one are out of order a little bit. This is a comment submitted by Mr. Branscom. He was concerned that this opening is an opening for potential avenues of attack by adjusting the definition of a closed system. Paul, do you guys want to address this?
I'm going to pass that to Steve.
Steve, okay.
Okay, on this particular one, what Mr. Branscom is raising is technically a legitimate concern, but we're falling into the area where the security requirements or needs or desires starts running counter to what may be an operational feature desired. Necessary for the election. In this particular case, the closed network definition that is being used with including the reference to the exemptions, and unfortunately I don't have the rule right up in front of me at the current time, it refers to the telecommunication security issues and permits the closed network to be able to transmit or transfer results from that network to another entity. Ideally, that should be another closed network or a closed portion of the network, but by the very nature of receiving that information from an external closed network, we start running into the issue that Mr. Branscom's raising about the introduction of the vulnerabilities. This becomes a decision rather on terms of the amount of risks that's going to be accepted within the system and the confidence in the use of the telecommunication security rules to reduce the risk of those particular vulnerabilities. It's more of a point to recognize that by doing so, we open up the possibility of a vulnerability at that point and that it needs to be inspected and reviewed. If we do go ahead and close the definition of closed networks to close out this possibility of availability, we still run into the issue about being able to support the need for transferring those results out of the closed network into a another system or device where it may be appropriate and desirable. I may have lost everyone on that, trying to avoid some of the academic technicalities that are involved.
Well, I think my perspective on that is this is very much a policy decision for Colorado as to the extent that you want to use telecommunications and, you know, be able to, you know, the ease with which you want to be able to collect information from precincts to counties and counties to the state and up to the Internet on election night. As I understand it, previously this has been very, very restricted. And I think as far as the entity testing, you can test it however the standard is written. But, you know, this is something that I think the state, the counties, and the interested citizens need to look at and see what you really want to do. And then try to craft language in the voting system requirements that reflect that intent.
Harvey. All right, so I see this as a relatively simple semantic issue. You don't call it a closed system if it's not really a closed system. It's very simple to test a closed system, a truly closed system, because you know where the boundaries of it are. It's much more complex to test the system that's been described under the caveat that's been added to the definition. I don't think it should be added to the definition. It should be provided where the language is used, or closed network should not be used as the phrase if it's not really closed.
So we need to look at where that term is used in the rules, right?
Yes.
Okay.
I would agree to that.
The next one is 45.1.9. Stephanie?
Sure. This was a comment submitted by Hart and Ercivic. They were concerned that the use of the phrase utilities for other election administration tasks would result in a requirement that COTS products be certified. Paul, I'm going to give this to you guys since this was language that you recommended.
Well, you already require that COTS products making up the voting system be part of the system that's tested and certified. So I'm not sure I quite understand Hart's concern. They may be thinking that perhaps applications that they market to support elections officials that are really outside the boundary of the voting system would be pulled in. It's a shame we don't have a representative of them there, because this really needs to be looked at. We're not trying to pull any applications into the voting system that don't have anything to do with running the election. I think you have to take a look at where the data for the election definition is coming from, and anything that handles that data, defining elections, creating ballots, programming the system, and down the chain of processes until the election results and backup files are made and put into storage. I think all of those elements that handle that data need to be within the boundary of the certified system, and any COTS applications that the system uses within that process really needs to be within the boundary of what Colorado at least defines as its trusted build, or whatever name we're going to give that thing. And basically, any COTS elements that are part of the voting system have to be functionally tested. The COTS exemptions have always been, as far as, you know, source code review and that type of analysis on COTS products. But even with that exemption, if they're going to be part of the system, they have to be tested with the system and shown to work.
Harvey?
No, and I concur with Mr. Kraft on that.
Okay. Let's, the next, we have a couple of comments on 45.2.1. Stephanie?
Sure. We received two comments, one from Mr. Branscombe and one from Hart InterCivic. I'm going to address the Hart InterCivic one first. Their concern was that the definition of a voting system differs in this rule from its definition of Rule 11.1.14. And they're correct, and I don't have an answer at the moment as to why they're not in line, but that's something that we can get fixed. And that was our original language, so we need to add some clarification and possibly change Rule 11.1.14 to shore that up.
Stephanie, from...
I'm sorry, Paul, go ahead.
Yeah, from our perspective, as you said, that was part of the original language.
Right.
We looked at it. It certainly seemed adequate. The one thing that it does include is that concept of the voting system having to have all the elements necessary to be a voting system, that you know, individual components are not necessarily a voting system unto themselves.
Right. The second comment was Mr. Branscombe's, and you actually added the language of Section 301B of HAVA. I'm just curious why.
I did. For clarity purposes, I actually think it's a good idea to put it in the rule, but for clarity purposes, but I did it mostly for my own use and for anybody who's reading this text to see what the actual HAVA definition is, which I think is perfectly adequate. I don't have an objection to it. I only inserted it because for clarity purposes.
Okay.
Thank you. 45.3B, Stephanie?
Sure. This was a comment submitted by Arapahoe County. Their comment was that we make reference to this test plan in the rule, and that they felt that there should be standards for the test plan also placed in the rule. I'm going to let Freeman Kraft McGregor address this.
Yeah, as I read their comments, Stephanie, they were actually suggesting that we just refer to the standards that are set later on in the rule for
okay.
the test plan, and we agree to that.
Okay.
45.3.1.
Yes, this was a comment submitted by Common Cause. I might give her a minute. This has to do with system modifications and testing modifications. And there was a concern that the process for system modifications is insufficient and leaves too much discretion. I don't actually disagree with that. I think we're still trying to figure out how to handle the language in 1335 and how we test that. There's some nuances to the language in 1335 that we're trying to work around. So with any luck, we'll have better requirements set forth before the formal rulemaking process. But you're right, what's currently in here is not sufficient. I don't think it's actually sufficient to 1335 and what it requires.
And Stephanie, if I may add.
Sure, go ahead, Paul.
Our impression was that the new statutory language really intended to provide a process for approval of those modifications outside of the certification process, and therefore we thought it was probably outside the scope of Rule 45. I mean, we agree that, you know, there probably need to be some rules and processes developed for that, but I don't know if it's appropriate to put those within the certification rule.
And that's a valid point, Paul. For those modifications that don't require a full certification, we may need to address them in a different rule.
We'll work on that one further.
Yes, we will.
I'm having a little trouble understating a modification that doesn't require full certification. I understand that because of the application and all that. But I'm wondering if what's being implied is that you can make a change to a system without actually retesting the entire system.
That's what 1335 says, that if a modification meets certain criteria, the entire voting system does not have to be retested and recertified.
Okay.
A good example of this, Al, would be, well, a good example of this would be the HART system in Colorado is currently certified with a particular group of Kodak scanners for scanning absentee ballots. If HART wanted to bring in another scanner that was outside the definition of their Colorado certified system, this section would provide a quick process, or is intended, at least by the legislature, provide a quick process for the secretary to make a decision on that. And the secretary's decision can be including it, or it can be, no, that's such a dramatic change that the entire thing needs to go back through certification. Also, if there is, say, a single element of the system changes, the precinct scanner, do you need to retest the entire election definition system if you can show that, in fact, the new precinct scanner takes files out of the old system the same way it used to, puts files back. You do regression testing to make sure that there's nothing that affect the other parts of the system. So do you need to do testing on the system other than on the device that was actually changed?
Just by way of information, is it the intent to make that decision open to public oversight?
I think what Stephanie is saying is we need to flesh that out better, and I think that's common.
I don't mean just in the rule as far as the definitional aspect, which I appreciate you're going to fix, but will that process allow for public experts to come in and question or help make that decision?
I don't know. I don't think we have that in front of us right now.
Okay. So.
The next rule that we received a comment about was 45.3.2. Stephanie?
Yes. This was a comment submitted by Jefferson County requesting that the rule allows for the Secretary of State to do additional testing at its discretion. And that has been requested to be removed. I will gladly let Jefferson comment on this. I will say, though, there are a number of very valuable reasons for this. I understand the frustrations expressed from the 2007 certification. However, there are a number of reasons to allow this in here. If there are problems identified in another jurisdiction, or if there's information and vendor documentation that we don't have a test for, but we need to ensure that the system does that for purposes of, for the benefit of whomever's going to purchase this, those types of things would fall under the additional testing criteria, purview. Any additional testing would be set forth in the test plan, which is then provided to the vendors for approval. So we would incorporate additional testing into a test plan so that it wasn't just sort of this off-the-cuff willy-nilly. But I think it's beneficial from, lessons learned in 2007 where, we found something in the testing process that couldn't be recreated. If another jurisdiction finds that, we can test it and then say, no, we couldn't make this happen. It's not really a security risk. So it could be a benefit. It also, something like that happens, it makes us retest it to say, we it's a double check on our work if necessary as well. Josh? I'm sorry, Bill. I don't mean to.
Go ahead, Josh. Go ahead.
I'm not the moderator.
That's all right.
From Jefferson County. Thank you for the clarification. I think the issue was not necessarily with getting rid of additional testing, but having whatever that additional testing is going to be a little better defined. But if the testing plan is going to do that, then
we will incorporate that into the testing plan.
Thank you.
Good comment. And there's a couple of other comments on that rule as well, Stephanie.
Oh, you're right. I'm sorry. Actually, all the comments are different. I'm going to start with Mesa County, who was concerned that the last sentence of Rule 45.6.2.1.1 was redundant to this rule. I actually wasn't clear on how it was redundant.
Well,
I'm sorry,
what
Sheila.
You just already answered
okay.
My point. If it's incorporated in the test plan and there's a plan for the additional testing, then it's covered.
Okay, good. The other comment we received was from Mr. Branscombe, and this has to do with opening up the certification process, not just the public demonstration, but the process as a whole to the public. Would you like to expound on that?
Yes, I would. I think it's terribly important that this certification test actually succeed in preventing difficult situations at election offices around the state by finding the problems that may be inherent in the voting system under test. And the best way to do that is to have as much access to as much information about the system under test as possible. And the easy way to avoid that is to have the test occur behind closed doors where the process of testing is unavailable to the public. I realize that there are logistical difficulties if all of the public decided they wanted to participate in the test. This hasn't been the case, actually. I'm not sure there's been a problem with too much public interest in actually attending the test. We have, Al Kolwitz and I, and a few others, have attended the public demonstration and found it to be really completely unhelpful for both parties. We attempted to make it helpful to the Secretary of State office, but we were unable to do so, I think. And it's very important that we not call the demonstration the public portion of the test, with the implication that the rest of it is not public. I prefer to put in the rule that the entire certification process is somehow made public under reasonable restrictions that are common sense and probably would become obvious. So I was very deeply concerned to see this idea of the public demonstration were changing to, I'm sorry, the demonstration turning into public demonstration as if the rest of it is absolutely not public. So that's my main concern here.
I think that at the end of the day, that's going to be a policy decision by the Secretary. Currently, as the rule is written, your interpretation is correct. The public demonstration is the public piece of the certification process. The extent to which the rest of it is open to the public is a decision beyond my control.
But we appreciate the input. I
yes.
mean, that's a good suggestion for us to think about as far as modifying the language to provide for more openness throughout the testing process.
May I add an illustration for the benefit of the Secretary?
I think we understand, Al, the issue, and I think we can take a look at that.
May I add a illustration for the benefit of the Secretary? The tests were designed in secret. They were run in secret. They were published on the internet as 40,000 pages that couldn't be searched. That's why we have this desire to be in there.
Which let me, I'm sorry, Bill, there I go again. I think we're working through those issues now. I think we're working through the searchable documentation, the test plans, the testing matrix. I mean, our goal here is to solve some of those problems that we identified in 2007. We're working toward that. This is kind of that final piece as to whether or not we do that. We understand where those problems lie. There's no question about that.
There's a timeliness issue here that the 9 months after the completion of certification isn't good enough for us to get documentation about it. We had information, live information, we brought to the public to the public demonstration for the purpose of educating the test board, which was brand new, most of them, and we were blocked, basically blocked. We were given 1 hour at the end of the public demonstration, and we were...
Again, I think we understand that. I mean, we...
Okay, but
we,
the timeliness thing is an issue with it. We have information to provide from the public. It's not just to the public, it's from the public. I want to make that clear.
Okay, and I understand that, and I respect that, and I appreciate that input. Again, I want to stay away from, you know, looking at that 2007 process. I understand. I was in the room. I understand the problems that were created during that public demonstration. We worked through that in the HART 621 demonstration to make it a more open process. I value those comments because we can make that process better.
And I think what would be helpful, given that we recognize the issue as we go forward, as we look at that and look at how to deal with that issue. If you have suggested language, because you know the issues as well, you know, you already alluded to them as far as, you know, if we have hordes of people, not likely. But some specific language that would define what that means. Is it simply open to public view? If you have input, should we stop the process and allow public input? You know, I think we need some specific language to sort of frame the issues, you know, so that we know exactly how to deal with the issues that may come up. You know, is it, like I say, is it simply just viewing the process as we're going along, or is it more than that? And if there are any security issues or whatever, if the language can deal with that, it would be helpful too, I think. So I think that's it on page one. although, let's see, 45.3.3.
Okay.
We have, well, let's see, I don't, maybe several comments. I'm not sure whether that's all together or not, but Stephanie?
Sure, I can.
Yeah, I am a little worried about our ability to, hopefully we'll speed up this.
I love that here. Sure. 45.3.3, the first comment we received was, again, from Jefferson County. The draft, we remove the timelines for each phase of the certification process. This was done for a variety of reasons, one of which being it ties everybody's hands. There's value to having those timelines in there because it holds everybody accountable. There's no enforcement procedure, but one of the problems that we had with all vendors in 2007 was the lack of adherence to those timelines and created problems for everybody. And so my purpose in removing those timelines was some phases may take more, some may take less. Let's not hold anybody's hands tied, but we're ultimately tied to the 120 days set forth in the statute. And I know Jefferson feels strongly about this issue.
Josh?
I believe in our comments we just included the idea that certification should be a project with timelines and milestones, and that those milestones need to be met. I know there was some participation issues in the previous certification on the side of the vendors, but one of our points was that certification of a system is just one of several steps, including procurement and training and testing and implementation of a system in a county, and when those expectations of the amount of time certification is going to take are exceeded, it has a severe impact. So if the timelines are not workable in their current form, maybe there's more timelines that we can help in rule better clarify the 120-day timeline in statute.
Josh, if I could respond. I've thought a lot about this particular issue, and in fact, we are now using Microsoft Project in order to set guidelines, time frames, measurable goals, and so forth. And that is not the reason for this change. In fact, we are trying to be more rigorous in the process that you described. My concern is that putting each of those time frames, breaking up 120 days, into rule takes away our flexibility when the world changes and some things can be done in 10 days, or some things may take 30, where the rule says 20. Putting those types of things into rule seemed to me not the best way to manage a process.
Thank you.
Okay.
Two points. First is having the timelines is a important from a systems management perspective because, in some sense, conforming to the timelines is itself a test of readiness. And in the extreme, one could imagine, which you would never permit, first phase is supposed to be get the documentation, and the last phase is run the final test. The first phase extends until day 119, and then we squish everything else into the end. That won't work. The second point. There are more people involved than paid staff that need to be available to kind of check in on what's going on with this test. And without a better rather than zero timeline, it's very difficult for people in the outside world to schedule their time to be a participant.
Harvey.
I actually agree with the change here to release the deadlines. I think the elephant in the room here is that the election officials are betting on the completion of a new voting system in time for an election. And I think that's a mistake. We do not want to rush the certification process in order to meet the timeline for an upcoming election. We shouldn't be considering the purchase of the equipment until the certification has been done. So that's what I think is not being said here. I think there are election officials who are batting on the side of the vendor in the certification process or potentially thinking about doing so. It's important that the certification process take enough time that it does its job properly. And I'm sympathetic to the idea of not requiring it to meet certain deadlines. Obviously, it's failed to do so in the past demonstrably.
The other references, the other comments here appear to be about ES&S commented lack of county participation. That's not referred to specifically. Harvey, you I think suggested additional language requiring real election testing, and so we can look at that as well. So,
yeah.
Is there anything further that needs to be said on those?
I'd like to make a quick pitch for the real election testing because I think it's the most important reason I drove down here today from Eagle County. It's clear to me from my experience at the front lines of elections that the systems that are coming through certification to date still have very rough edges, and they're extremely annoying to election officials, and election officials don't want to admit it because it's the tool that they're absolutely depending on to accomplish their role. And it's shocking to be up at 3 o'clock in the morning with an election system on election night that's failing in various ways, and I have plenty of evidence for this and documentation, but it's just horrifying to think of putting the election officials in the counties through this kind of pain when those things could have been caught in a certification process and ought to have been caught. And I think the only way they will be caught is if the final piece of the certification test is a live election, which is heavily monitored by the Secretary of State's office, so that each little glitch in the actual functioning of the process in a live election scale, real election, gets documented, and then the determination is made whether the system is ready for prime time to be actually used in other elections. And this also guarantees that a certain consistency in the manner of operating elections will be spread around Colorado as we presumably move to different election jurisdictions to do this test. And I propose doing it in a place where it's not known that the experts on using that particular system are standing by to operate it. And this, of course, gets into another piece of the rule I want to talk about later, but that's about whether real experts should be standing by to operate the equipment or should people who are likely to be running them in elections be standing by to operate for the test. So I really want to strongly push for this real live practical test as the final step, and that's what I've written as my extra phase in my comment.
Okay, and if I have any comments, Stephanie?
Yes, you may, Paul.
Pardon?
Did you want to make a comment, Paul?
Yes.
Go ahead.
Basically, I think we like Harvey's idea of an election test, but I think this needs to be approached with extreme caution. Number one, before you take a system into a real election, it needs to be thoroughly tested within the certification testing. It shouldn't be, if you're going to do anything, view the alternative process of testing in a real election as an additional step beyond what you're doing now. The impact that will bring to your counties, though, is that will give you an additional delay. You know, once a system has completed the formalized functional testing, then there will remain this additional test in real time. So that means if you're going to do the additional testing in a real election on a major election, then you could be potentially delaying the ability of other counties to use that for up to 2 years. If you are going to allow the real election test to be done on a minor or a municipal election, then you may not have a large enough election to catch the kind of issues that Mr. Branscombe's talking about. There are always going to be issues in these systems that are not called in certification. Unfortunately, testing is a sampling effort, and you can never test, you know, 100% of the universe of possibilities. Testing plans are written to verify that particular standards that have been identified have been set up, and you know, you cannot evoke every condition that a system might possibly come to in the real world in every county. Part of the process should be similar to what the EAC has done now with their process, where they are soliciting feedback from jurisdictions that are using these systems and interested parties on how they actually work in the real world. With those kinds of facts being funneled back into the certification test, which takes you back to those additional tests that the secretary may run at his discretion. So it's a neat idea. I've just got concerns as to how easy that is going to be to implement, or difficult it's going to be to implement, and how you're going to do it.
Harvey?
Yes. So one point is that we're moving rather rapidly towards a mail ballot election, which tells me that there is a lot of, even the municipal elections are accumulating large amounts of mail ballots, and in many portions of the test there would be a similar scale that you would find in a municipal election or a county election. It's at any rate it's so important that the certification process also, we know, is a several year process from the vendor point of view. The turnaround time to actually understand what the definition is going to be, designed for it, they have to do their testing for it. Then, of course, it goes into the state testing process, or the federal testing process first, in fact, then the state process. So the fact of an every 2 year timeline actually isn't that bad. It's not so dissimilar to the situation now. It's only a question of phasing your system into that right timing, and it would make sure that a certified system had at least a year before it actually was going to be rolled out into other counties once it passed this final test. And of course, I do agree that it's absolutely necessary that the test prior to this final practical test be as we are planning in any case, so that a bad system is not given to a county to run a real election on. I certainly agree with Mr. Kraft on that. So I don't think it's as bad as Mr. Kraft is suggesting in terms of timing.
Well, I'm suggesting as far as timing that you're exactly right. The system architect starts off today using his current development tools and his current knowledge of the issues in voting system security and functionality, and he spends 2 to 3 years developing a system. He then spends 2 to 3 years taking it through certification testing at the federal level, and then he brings it at some point to Colorado, where he could potentially have another 2 years from the point he begins Colorado testing to the end point. So basically, when the system first becomes available, it's 8 years old and built on system development tools that are now totally out of date.
Sheila?
And I'm just urging caution in the way the process is developed, keeping that in mind.
I just wanted to go ahead and comment, since Harvey brought it up, that election officials want to spend money on voting equipment, and therefore we may push the certification timelines. The truth is that we are normally caught in a situation where there are requirements for us to purchase certain types of systems in order to do the things that the federal and state government want us to do. But in the past, we've been stuck with not having any equipment to purchase in order to accomplish our goal. So the timelines are important to the counties.
The next comments have to do with 45.4. There are a couple of rules that ES&S commented on. They're concerned over the proposed addition of fees for certification, vendor fees. I don't know that we need to discuss that. I think that's a policy issue that we want to raise. There's pluses and minuses, and I don't, again, to the extent that we're trying to do some work on the language, I don't know that we need to discuss that right now, but I think at least if that's retained in the draft rules, I suspect we need to have a pretty good debate about that at the public rulemaking hearing, because that is a big change, and there are some impacts to what vendors may do, whether they would submit systems for testing and so forth. So additional comments would certainly be solicited if we keep that as a proposed rule. Is there anything further we need to say about that? And then Arapahoe County had an editorial suggestion that I think we'll take a look at as well in 45.4.6. So if I could move to 45.5, quite a few comments there. So Stephanie, if you'll start maybe working us through those.
Sure. The first comment set of comments was on 45.5.1.3, and we actually received comments from ES&S, Mr. Branscombe, and Common Cause. I'll start with Common Causes. That was an easy one. Inserting or state after the VSTL to account for incorporating testing from other states, and I actually think that's a wonderful suggestion. I think we should overlook that. The ES&S comment actually goes along with a number of other sub-portions of this rule, and it has to do with it was made by others. I believe Common Cause and Mesa County were also included in this. Review of the documentation by the vendors before it's released to the public. And there was some question about how this process worked or requiring that it go to the vendors beforehand. I will say under Title 24 it has to, essentially. Title 24 under the Open Records Act requires that any proprietary or trade secret information be redacted out of that documentation. That is not something that we typically have. That was part of the reason why it took 9 months to get all the documentation released from the 2007 process, because the vendors all had to go through their own portion of documentation looking for proprietary and trade secret information, and then we had to go through it with our counsel to look at, does it really qualify or not? So all the vendors will see that the documentation prior to it being released to the public, and all things that are supposed to be redacted out will be redacted out. I don't know, it seems like there was a comment about, and maybe from you, Sheila, about releasing it to the vendor prior to our announcement. Was that correct? Or am I making things up?
No, I think that really actually was my intent, is that they have an opportunity to review it and make sure that there were not any misleading statements in the public announcement before it went out.
Okay. Thank you.
You're talking about once the certification is complete?
Mm-hmm. Okay. We can definitely take a look at that.
Are we talking about the redaction?
Redaction. Did you want to add something,
Jenny? Well, I mean, even as I'm listening to you talk about your need to review once things are redacted, and I remember it just taking a very long time, and that's sort of why it sort of raised a flag to me. If there are if we know that there are legal requirements, would it be helpful for vendors if we just made clear this would be acceptable, this wouldn't be acceptable? This is how to approach your redaction process. And again, I'm not an expert here on that, but I just recall that it took a very long time, and if there's a way that we can sort of put our best foot forward about what our expectations are as a state, that might streamline.
And I'll make, if I may, make two comments on that. One is, one of the things that we've discussed is requiring from vendor documentation, from anything submitted by the vendor, asking them to submit to us up front what they request to be redacted out of that. So we kind of get on the front end so it doesn't hold us up on the back end. And it gives us time to work with them to determine whether or not it really does fall under Title 24. My second comment on that kind of builds on what some of the earlier discussion was of if we do documentation properly and we keep out of the testing notes and documentation all of that proprietary and trade secret information, you cut out that step. But there is a lot of that type of information submitted in the vendor documentation that I would prefer to see it on the front end and know so that we don't have that hold up after the announcement.
I'm sorry, let me make sure I understand. You're saying if we ask the vendors to, when they submit stuff, to mark in what they assert is confidential or whatever, then we could save a huge amount of time, I think.
Yes, yes.
I don't know whether we have any language to that effect yet.
I don't think we do yet, but I think it's something we should.
Okay.
That's definitely
Stephanie, it's Paul. One thing that you're going to hit is, at least one thing that I have seen before, is that the vendors respond to that kind of request by simply marking everything they give you as confidential.
Mm-hmm. Well, and Paul, that's a valid point. And that did happen to us in 2007, although we were able to go back with them and say, no, that's not sufficient under Colorado law.
Yeah, yeah.
Al?
Yes, it's, Ms. Secretary, it's a common industry practice, as you may know, to not accept proprietary information from outsiders. And the reason for that is manyfold, but one of the big ones is that you don't want to expose staff to proprietary information that they may walk away with, use, and get sued and come back to you as the source of the problem. From our perspective, we would like you to establish a policy that would not permit any proprietary information to come into the building. Don't allow it in here in the first place. Get rid of the problem.
Stephanie, I'm going to have to disagree.
I
do not think you... Okay.
No, you're fine, Paul. I disagree with that as well. I don't think that you can actually... understand and test a system without the proprietary information of the system.
I have built at least two of the biggest systems that you all will have seen, and I didn't have that experience.
Well, to do some of the types of testing that Colorado is talking about, particularly the security pieces, you cannot confidently do that kind of testing and have any real confidence in your work product if you do not have complete access to the details of the system, including the source code, the design of elements. To do it without access to that information is basically black box testing, which everyone decried a long time ago. You simply have to have information on the system, how it was built, and you have to have appropriate non-disclosure agreements in place to take care of those issues.
Hey, Stephanie.
Do you want me to move on? Okay. Go ahead.
One thing, we are getting some noise on the phone, and I don't know, it may be that Paul or Steve or Kate, you might need to mute your phone when you're not speaking. I mean, we're hearing a fair amount of noise, and I think if you make sure that your phones are muted when you're not speaking, that might help us on our end.
Okay, I will do that.
Thank you. And I also want to point out that we're on pace to finish in about 6 hours of total. And at some point, we're probably going to have to skip past individual comments. So again, I'll withhold judgment on that right now. but I'm, among the things I'm thinking about is if we simply can't go through the individual comments, but maybe then just going to some general topics about which we got comments and then closing. I definitely want to leave some time at the end, say a half an hour, for everyone present to at least have a little bit of time to add to what we already have. So I'm not going to forego that. So any event, Stephanie?
Sure. On, again, on 45.5.1.3, I'm going to go to Mr. Branscombe. You made a comment about change the term and definition so it's not limited to a DRE. Would you like to comment on that? At least I believe that's what you said.
Confused by that particular paraphrase of my comment. My comment was to refer back to the statute 601.5, I think it is, which contains within it the VSTL and the other state, 1-5.601.5. I don't think this relates to DRE here. Was the intention to make sure that all of that type of testing falls into this category. The testing that's used prior to what that's supplemented by whatever happens in Colorado all should fall under the requirement to provide this transparency. That's all.
Another point on that. In 45.5.1.3, the legislature granted the opportunity to use other states' certifications of voting systems. I have a different impression of what this rule calls a voting system than do most of the documents that I read about this rule. The voting system, as I understand it, includes all of the elements needed to conduct an election, including the canvas procedure, the database for accessing registration and ballot type information, and so on. And as a consequence, when I look at 45.5.1.3, I see it through a lens that says that there is a high unlikelihood that any state will have a voting system that matches our voting system. I want to make sure that lens that I'm using is correct.
That, as far as the term of the definition of voting system?
As far as what this rule is referring to.
Well, if the definition is referring to a voting system, that's been defined in the rule.
Correct. And it includes things like the canvassing procedures and so on.
Under HAVA?
Let's say, just for demonstration purposes, things that are call-outs for things that should be demonstrated in 45.6.1.2.
Al, I may be wrong about this, but my impression is, for purposes of voting system certification, we're using the term voting system in a more narrow sense than you're talking about. For purposes of considering our voting system, the way we vote, which is a continuum of processes that includes canvas processes and so forth, I think that's true. But I don't know that that's part of what the application for certification of a voting system. I don't think it includes canvas processes.
I think that is correct. That's the common interpretation of what's being said by others. But by rule, a voting system requires everything required to conduct this election.
We'd narrow the definition in the rule.
No, expand the understanding of what's needed to make a successful election
so
system.
So that we certify the canvas process?
Front to back, the whole system.
Go ahead, Paul.
Once again, I think this is an area where we've got a couple of different entities. Within Rule 45, talking about the testing and certification of voting systems that have not even yet been used in the state, a voting system is, in fact, the the item that the vendor brings through a door to have certified as a voting system. And our definition of a voting system there needs to be regulatory so that we do cover things such as, no, if you're only bringing a DRE, that's a nice DRE, but it's not a voting system because it can't do all the things that you do to conduct an election. And those things being the narrow subset of defining elections, tabulating ballots in different voting groups, and reporting results. The other item that's out there, though, Alan, you're exactly correct, I think, is once Colorado moves to certify a voting system, then, yes, that certification is going to include the conditions of use that the Secretary imposes on the system. So once the system has been certified and it's being installed in a county, then, yes, it will have Colorado-specific procedural requirements wrapped around it, and at that point, it will be unique to Colorado's use of that particular system. As far as the systems coming in the door, you're going to see pretty much with all the vendors now that we see the same exact systems from state to state, and the task becomes one of measuring that system against a particular state's requirements.
Mr. Hobbs, could you help me define where it says that a voting system is what a vendor brings in through the door?
I think that's in 1-5-part 6. I mean, I think that is the application process for certification of a voting system. I think they
and that was a conceptual.
Where is this?
That was a conceptual description.
Oh, oh, not here. And say what it says, please.
I mean, I'm sorry, what, Al. Maybe I'm getting lost. Your suggestion for the draft rules is what? What would you like to see in the language of the rule?
I would like to see the rule use the definition of voting system in the rule rather than something external to the rule or something made up.
Let me just comment, this is Bernie Buescher, that the definition of both voting system and electromechanical voting system is in statute, and that's not something that we can change.
Nobody's asking that. There's many cases where language is locally defined. In fact, there are glossaries within statutes which use variants of commonly termed or statutorily defined terms. And in this rule, a voting system, I think, is considered to be everything required to conduct an election. And I refer to, and I'm not sure what version of the rule that I'm referring to here, but it was 45.1.18, 45.2.1.1, 45.2.1.2, 45.3.1, and so on.
And 45.2.1 defines a voting system as the term is defined in HAVA section 301B.
Okay. Let me see where that is here. 45.2. Right. No single component can be considered a voting system. A voting system needs all of the parts.
It needs all the parts that are defined in HAVA. Or it needs all the parts to do the things that's defined in HAVA.
Yes, which is everything that's needed to conduct an election. I think. I mean, I could be reading it incorrectly.
But on the other hand, I would point out that one doesn't really want to have one vendor necessarily providing all of these components of the HAVA-defined voting system. So this brings up another topic, which is about how the rule could accommodate different vendors who are providing different portions of the voting system. It's another one of my general comments. I don't think it appears in the text because I didn't encounter that as I was doing my review of the rule as far as I got. But I think that's an important point, that we need to be able to accommodate different vendors and not define what the voting system is based on what a specific vendor wants to provide us.
Well, maybe we ought to move on. I mean, I'm not sure, if there's a concrete suggestion, that would be helpful. I see in 1335, it amended the election code definition of electromechanical voting system. It added a definition for paper-based voting system. It added a definition for electromechanical voting system as what it includes. There's some other definitions that are in the election code. I think we're bound by that. So, at least I think the intent of the rules is to use the terms consistent with the statute. And if we're not doing that, which I think was what I thought, I think I heard the panel say that, then we do need to probably adjust the rules.
If I said statute, I meant rule. And you might solve my problem by pointing from 45.2.1 at 45.6.1.2 to incorporate 45.6.1.2 as further clarification of 45.2.1.1.
Okay, we'll take a look at that. Stephanie, what's next?
Okay. Um, 45.5.2, we received a comment from ESNS. They were concerned the majority of the standards are 2002 VSS and 2005 VVSG. Paul, did you guys look at this one?
This is which one, Stephanie?
45.5.2.
Yes. We basically agree that there is probably further editing in 45.5.2 to remove redundancies. Some of those things in there, though, are "quote unquote" redundant from the 2005, which you're not under anymore. So there's a question whether you want to maintain those as state-specific standards, in which case they should remain in the rule. But we would agree, yes, that any real redundant language out of 2002 can be removed from Rule 45. We did that to some extent, but we did not do a thorough edit for redundancy.
Okay. Well, we'll gladly take a look at that then.
There's a series of comments from Harvey that I wonder if we can just take under advisement. Harvey, is there any? They look kind of self-explanatory, but
yep, I think they are. But this is the meat of the requirement. And in fact, my first one actually is to state the requirement for the voting system, to refer it to the statute, and to say the voting system shall conform to all stated requirements in this rule. So that statement's not actually made in the rule, which I find rather curious. So. That's actually my first comment. It's not really referred to in the abstract here. And then the others are, in fact, I think they are self-explanatory. It's very important that we consider, just because a vendor provides an election testing mode, that for a logic and accuracy test, for example, our statute actually calls for testing not to be done in test mode, as I understand it. And therefore, it would be good for the rule to conform to that and actually be clear.
And Bill, if I may comment on that, I actually agree. I don't think that was the intent of the rule, but I'm happy to clarify that.
Thank you.
Now, Stephanie, one concern that we have is several of these systems have test modes which are important to be used in the election definition and system readiness preparation by users. So I wouldn't want a total prohibition against certification testing and test mode, because then you can't get to some of those functions, which I think really need to be validated and shown to work. But certainly the portions of the certification test which are testing functions that would be conducted during an election should all be conducted in test or in election mode.
Okay.
Yes.
It's a little bit circular here, because there is a logic and accuracy test that's being tested. But the logic and accuracy test itself, we should be, even if the vendors don't provide this yet, we should be putting some pressure on the vendors to make it possible to logic and accuracy test in election mode and not in a test mode. And I realize it's not possible today with current equipment, but we're talking about a rule that will be passed by future equipment, and it doesn't have to be a hard and fast rule. There are a couple other cases where we'll find I've suggested things that are optional, and this is one of those things although our statute actually has some, is pretty clear on this, so I'm not sure it should be optional, but we're in a little bit of a behind the time, the vendors are behind the times of Colorado statute in this respect, I think, but we ought to have something clarify this.
Thank you.
Steve Freeman.
Go ahead, Steve.
I have a particular comment on that one. I think the actual initial comment that Mr. Bascom made was against the actual statement about the logic and accuracy test. And one of the things that you run afoul through on this is the different requirement in terms of exercising the actual logic of the system as part of that test against the requirement to keep those logic and accuracy results separate from the election results. That is difficult to do without making some difference in terms of the code that is being exercised, unless you go to strictly a procedural route. And history has shown in actual elections that that has been a rather, unfortunately, I won't say frequent, but it definitely occurs case where there's errors that's created in the election results when those logic and accuracy results get added into the final totals. So there needs to be a distinction somehow on how those are managed. This is probably going to be a requirement that's going to be a work in progress trying to find out and review these processes to make sure they're adequate. And if it is a procedural solution, this needs to be tested as part of the process to make sure that there's provisions within it that such a problem can be avoided.
Yeah, quite so, but it's a very important issue. And there are some technical solutions, I think, also that can be brought to bear in addition to procedural.
Yes.
May I add just one thing? In case it's not clear, one of the reasons for insistence on production mode is that when you flip a switch into test mode or give any other signal that you're operating in some way different than production, that represents a threat. That represents an opportunity for software to grab that indicator and behave differently than it would in production mode.
Thank you.
Yes. This is Steve again. Let me mention on that one, when we get into a particular issue, we're getting into a situation that cannot be tested with functional testing. It has to be coupled with a source code review to go in there and see what's actually happening at those particular points, which is something to be considered in terms of implementing type of test standard against this.
Let's see, I think we have another hard intercivic comment about 45.5.2.2, but redundant to 2002 BSS.
We can look at that.
Covered. Next comment is from Arapaho, performance standard for ballot scanning.
And actually, if I may, Bill, there's a whole series from 45.5.2.2 to 45.5.2.2.4. We received a number of comments regarding the processing times for ballots, the standard that's set in the rule. There was some overwhelming concern over this. So, Paul, could you or Steve or Kate address the time frames that are set forth for ballot processing in that rule?
Yeah, I'll start. Steve will probably jump in. Basically, the time frames that are in the rule are from your prior rule. And in the spirit of not wanting to reduce your requirements and having understood that y'all went through a rule development process and took input from stakeholders before, we assumed that, you know, those were time frames or metrics for performance that y'all had made a choice to adopt. We agree that they are a little slow. I mean, 100 and basically 100 ballots for a precinct scanner, probably, or for a central count, was probably a precinct scanner. I think this is an area where the vendors and the clerks need to weigh in and look at, okay, what really is acceptable for Colorado? You know, what kind of throughput do we need? How big are our elections? So it's something that we left in place, and I think it deserves a revisit and more of a look at.
Okay.
But I think it's going to take a lot of input from the clerks to come to a good answer.
Okay.
I think those timing requirements are bordering on the insane, actually.
Actually, this is Steve. I'd like to make one comment. I've been over this two or three times to take a look at it. And to be honest, I'll have to admit that I think the one requirement for the central calendar, the more I look at it, it looks like it may be a typo in that requirement. So the federal standards requiring the testing that there be a minimum of 300 ballots run per hour, and there's some other standards in that that indicate a higher rate of speed that's very achievable, but unfortunately we do not have a really good accurate level. That's what Paul was referring to in terms of what that level should be and it needs to be defined. But I'm pretty sure, the more I look at that, the more I'm sure that one reference is probably actually a typo. It should have been a different value.
Now, another approach to this issue, which Steve actually came up with, he didn't mention it, so I'm going to throw it in here with due credit. The other approach you can take to this is require the vendor to specify their metrics for these performance measures and then verify those published metrics in certification testing so that then the clerks can make informed decisions as to whether the system will meet their needs or not. I mean, that's the big thing you're trying to prevent here is a county discovering on election night that they have two central count scanners and they need eight.
This is Pam from Jefferson County. I think the reason you got a lot of comments, it just seemed arbitrary. I think the comment, previous comment to determining by the specifications of the system and testing to those specifications would be more helpful. I think we found it with previous experience with testing that there was operator error involved as well that impacted the result. And so I think we're more concerned about, you know, what is that standard and testing to that standard and getting the full impact input on what that was. And I would argue that the previous rule was inadequate.
Yeah. Stephanie, we're two. I don't want to.
I think we can actually skip the two heart ones.
Yeah.
We can skip the Jefferson County duplicative of 2002. Charitable batteries. I'm checking on 45.5.2.3.16 because the comment was that it was covered in Rule 11. There, you know what, I'm going to 45.5.2.3.17. We discussed this at the first meeting with regard to testing useful equipment life and the standard that's in the rule. And we received comments from both Mesa County and ESNS. The consultants agreed that this was kind of a Paul and Kate and Steve, I don't mean to put words in my mouth, so correct me if I'm summarizing this wrong. This is a difficult thing to test, and it's somewhat kind of arbitrary, if you will. I'm creating feedback.
Yes, Steve,
again.
You want to comment? Steve?
Sorry, I had to go mute because I was asking about a phone call. What reference are you talking about?
Okay, we are on 45.5.2.3.17, which is the requirement for the 8-year life in the old rule.
Oh, okay.
We discussed at the first meeting, and at the first hearing, you said that this was difficult to enforce and measure, so you want to take it from there?
Yeah, there's a whole body of theory in terms of trying to test to this particular standard, and unfortunately, the standards being used in tests have way, basically, they've come out. The part of the problem that has to go along with is that the original standards for this requirement were based on a Department of Defense procurement policy requiring some static testing for life cycle predictability in terms of reliability. Those tests have just not been successful in terms of testing against the voting system, And part of the reason is that the changes on the voting system have tended to require changes even quicker than that life cycle can occur. One of the factors that comes into this is the procurement of parts for repairs and everything. Components that may be used in the system quite often become outdated and can no longer be replaced in shorter than that type of team framework. There's a lot of reasons for this that really doesn't have anything to do with the status, but it does have to do with the ability to be able to test these systems, and so the results tend to be unreliable. I would be glad to see this type of testing going on, but it really is outside of the scope of the state to be able to do. This needs to be done something at the VSTOL level with the resources and hardware testing that's involved, and that needs to be worked through the federal requirement program, not through the state.
I think that comes down to we'll take a look at that again. The next series.
Before we leave that.
Yes. Al.
This is Al. This is a circumstance where one of the sections was not called out, but there's relevant content that affects what we've just done. So shall I delay that for later or bring that here?
I sure understand. You mean something that there was no comments about, a rule?
Right. It's not on this list, but it's in this topic.
Okay, well, let's come back to that at the end then. I think we're trying to go through the comments that we received. So hold that.
Okay. The next portion of the role that we received a vast amount of comments on was 45.5.2.4.3. This is the independent security analysis that's to be done before the vendor comes into the state for certification. This is another one of those topics we discussed on the second. The consultant said this would be a policy decision on the Secretary of State's office. It was a requirement that was in the rule that went into effect March 31st of 2008 that we now are relooking at, and the viability from the vendor's perspective, because the current VSTLs are not. This isn't one of those testing criteria that they have to go through to become certified by the EAC. So it's a little bit outside of their purview. It's very much outside our purview. So it's definitely something we will be obviously taking those comments into consideration and looking at again. Paul, is there anything you'd like to add to that?
Yes, Stephanie.
Okay.
As you said, the prior rules independent review process was never put into place because it was only required for systems that came in after March of 08. So it's never been applied to a system. Just looking at it as it wasn't really workable. I mean, you wouldn't have to do a whole lot of analysis on systems comparing them to the old rule to tell real quickly that none of them could pass. That said, security analysis on these systems, I think, really needs to be done at a level higher than the current VSTLs are doing it. We do this work for California. Ohio does that kind of work. The state of Florida, the states of Maryland, and Georgia are all doing security analysis to one extent or another. If you certify absent an analysis of security, you are at some point going to have to deal with someone finding a security weakness in a system that you had previously certified. The importance of the security analysis, though, and I need to make this very clear to everybody who's thinking about this. These systems, as they come through the door, are going to have security weaknesses. The industry has not had very long to work on putting state-of-the-art security into voting system. 4 years ago, it wasn't really an issue. Nobody seemed to care about it. I think they have been working to develop more secure systems, and some of those systems are in the EAC process. So we're dealing with systems that are imperfect, that have security weaknesses. The importance of the security analysis and doing a really good security analysis is so that you become aware of what the vulnerabilities are to these systems, and then you can make informed decisions with confidence on your conditions of use and the procedures you put around them. The systems come, I think everybody in the business now is aware that they've got to provide some prescription for hardening. The Secretary's test process needs to review that hardening process and make sure that it's adequate, make decisions about whether the hardening should be increased. And, of course, when you increase the hardening on a system beyond what the vendor recommends, then there is the issue of will the system still work after it's hardened. So, important issue area. Our highest and best recommendation is that Colorado join the other states that are doing this kind of testing and try to come up with, you know, a joint testing program, because this is an expensive process. You know, basically, you're looking at to do the source code review on a sampling level, not a detailed level, but a sampling level using automated tools and spot checks of different known security issues, and a red team penetration testing of a system, you're looking at about a $200,000 set of tests. I can't see it being good public policy that a vendor should have to take a system through multiple states and have that same analysis done by each state at a cost of $200,000. We did not go into, I mean, kind of with that approach, and the fact it's a policy decision, we did not address some of the issues as to whether the open source standard for evaluation was appropriate or out of date, because, frankly, it's a policy decision where Colorado needs to figure out what it's going to do, and then once there, once that decision's been made, then we can work with you talking about, okay, how to do it.
Okay.
May I?
Al.
We pursued the security aspect of the election system in some depth, and it led us to the governor's office, whose data processing people actually conducted the higher-level security testing. And we were totally shut out from being able to see anything about what they had done. Typically, in a modern security analysis, you would see at least a threat matrix that made available to people like us information that would at least show us that you saw that there was a problem here and that maybe you might do something about it. Now, you may feel uncomfortable releasing even that level of information, which I disagree with, but if you do, you have a tool available to you, which I would hope that you would incorporate in the rule, which is to allow for the swearing in as election officials, people that you approve, that would be from the public with the authority to go through and inspect the security testing, the threat matrix, the solutions that are designed to overcome the threats. Now, there is a as Paul says, an enormous amount of work to make a system secure. And we don't deny that at all. But I can guarantee you that there's knowledge in Colorado that you would benefit from bringing in rather than shutting out. And I would encourage the rule to be expanded to find a way to bring some of this talent into the mix.
Jenny?
When you all say you're re-examining, can you tell, I mean, are you thinking along the lines of the recommendation to keep this independent test requirement? Are you thinking about eliminating it? What do you mean by re-examine? Or is everything on the table?
Well, everything's on the table. I think we're having those discussions on how we do it, how we require it be done, if it be done, you know, the fiscal impact of it. We're examining all aspects of it in determining, do we keep it in the rule and require it of the vendors? Do we take it out? Do we do what, you know, the statute allows us and do it, in, as Paul mentioned, in partnership with other states because that's more cost effective? How do we do that?
Well, I would just offer two comments, and I think this is part of my comment on this issue overall. I mean, yes, we now have the authority to go to other states, and it sounds like that might be a good approach, but a couple things have come up in terms of, well, is the system the same exact system that's been tested in other states? And that was sort of our reluctance to rely on other states' concerns with systems in the past, so I don't know that we would rely on them for testing. So that would be just something to factor in, but also that it should be, I don't know that it would be independent if we rely on the same state for both the certification process and the independent analysis of the security. So that if we, so we would just, I would recommend that we try to make that distinction in that such a case. So if Ohio is the state we're relying on for certification, we would use a different state's analysis for the independent analysis. So we do maintain that independence.
Thank you, and I do respect that, and that is a good point. I would add too that we have gotten a lot of questions on, and I know that these were questions that came up while the bill was going through the legislative process as well, about incorporating information from other states. By no means are we going to incorporate any testing done in another state if the firmware version, the software version, any version of it is different. We will, you know, they may test different versions of different equipment, only some of which is used in Colorado. Only those pieces will we actually incorporate in. Everything else we do our testing ourselves. So we're not going to have that reliance on something that we're not actually using, because that would just sort of be in the face of the certification.
And I would just also add briefly that I really agree with the consultants and the perspective that these are important tests.
Yeah.
We constantly make modifications for use, and that's something that we've been concerned about along the way, because we know that there are weaknesses in these systems. But better we know about the weaknesses than ignore them.
And I agree with you on that. I think it can be problematic to know about the weaknesses, but many of those weaknesses can be mitigated through other methods. But I think I agree with you, it's important to know what those weaknesses are.
And Stephanie, another something that I forgot in my comments, and I think it's important for everybody looking at this to be aware of it. Everyone's well aware that we did a major cut job of many, many pages of detail on source code and security specifications. The source code stuff was pretty much deleted because it was redundant of the 2002 standards. The security specifications, specific specifications that were in the prior rule for security evaluation and standards, those kind of specifications would be appropriate to try to enforce if you're paying someone to build you a system, or if you're a system developer developing a new system from the market from scratch. Simply go out and try to measure someone else's system that's already been developed against those standards, unless they just happen to have developed to one of those standards, system's not going to pass. So the approach that we tried to steer you to is, okay, let's do an analysis. If we're going to do an analysis, let's do an analysis of the system to determine what the vulnerabilities are, and give the state and the clerks some real information to make decisions as to whether the security is adequate and what you know, conditions of use need to be put around it. So, and I know that's a circular argument, but all this stuff seems to be.
Thank you, Paul.
Stephanie, if you want to keep, what's the next item?
Okay.
Trying to figure out the timing here, but Harvey?
Well, while there's dead air here, I'd like to concur with what Jenny said and what Paul Kraft has said. There are a class of tests that are very critical. These are the security tests. A lot of work has gone into this rule on security. Not so much work has gone into the functional specifications that we just jumped by, and I had a large number of comments on them, which I am not addressing right now, but I think that kind of level of effort should be applied to the functional testing as well. There's a class of tests that are amenable to being put out of state, and the security testing, like red team testing or so, is of that class, and I don't think source code review or red team type security testing should be done in multiple states where there's identical functional testing going on. The functional testing, however, is important to keep in state, I think, and we should put at least as much energy into that as the security considerations we're talking about now. So.
Very briefly,
Al.
High among the threats to any system is the threat of a insider either accidentally or purposefully contaminating the results of this election. And the easiest place to do that is in the vote counting system. It's difficult for an individual to go modify the mail ballots that are coming in or so on and so on and so on. But at the very end, you're sitting at a desktop with the election results sitting on your screen. And if you have the proper authorities, you can actually change the election results. Just reach in and change it. And all of the systems in Colorado seem to have that capability to do that. I want to make sure that this security vision that's in the minds of whoever is text writing this rule includes coverage of all aspects of the election, not just whether an administrative password will be detected correctly. And I should add, we have experience with the case that I just gave you as an illustration in Boulder County. Charges were filed with the district attorney that the assistant or something, county clerk, was actually alone in a room with that machine and the election results, which is against the law. And we cannot rely on the law to fix the problem because the district attorney responded to that complaint by saying, we got criminals to worry about.
Let's think about where we are with the time and maybe figure out where we go from here. I think if everyone is willing, I think we could go till 12:30. Freeman, Kraft, McGregor, are you guys able to stay on until for another 40 minutes or so?
Yes. Yes.
Yes.
And then my proposal might be that that we shift gears. And we're working our way through the comments that we received, which is what we wanted to focus on. But rather than us just doing them one after another, maybe give the folks that are present an opportunity, divide up the time that's left and let each of you highlight for yourself what you think needs to be highlighted so that we understand the comments and can incorporate them meaningfully in the next draft. That makes some sense.
That works. If I could address one more kind of big topic on here
before we do that. And I guess I was going to ask a question. If there's some one or two or three topics that we really do need to hit before we do that, I'd be happy to do that. And I think that's what you're saying.
Yes. And there's only one. I alluded to it earlier, but I want to come back to it because it did come, and then we can do that. We received a number of comments in 45.6.2.1.5 regarding vendor and county participation. One of the documents that was on the table over there had some draft language for two topics, one of which was the county participation. You know, we've mandated in here that the vendor be present for the testing, and we left out the counties. Now, House Bill 1335, the intent of that was to take into account the you know, kind of best practices and procedures at the county level, but we inadvertently left out including county participation in the rule. So I've put together some draft language. It will be more finely tuned when we propose the rules, but I wanted those that made comments on that to know that that was an oversight on our part. You guys were not meant to be, you weren't excluded, you just weren't specifically included.
We just screwed up.
I will take responsibility for this one. Along those lines, too, there were a number of comments about the lack of the vendor being allowed to touch the equipment in the testing. That is something, obviously, we need to look at and consider further. Are there times when it is appropriate for a vendor to touch that equipment to demonstrate something, or should the county person be there to do that? Those are some things that we'll be taking a look at these comments and thinking through that and incorporating whether or not, from a perceptually, it looks bad to have the vendor touching the equipment. We are here to test this equipment, to recreate what the vendor says it can do. But maybe in partnership with the counties, we can actually work through some of those issues where it might appear that a vendor needs to touch the equipment. The other topic, which is on that list as well, is ballot marking. We received a couple of comments in response to the allowance for vendors to supply pre-marked ballots. We didn't use pre-marked ballots in 2007. It was a daunting task to mark tens of thousands of ballots manually. So we wanted to allow, we wanted to allow for the vendors to provide pre-marked ballots. I recognize that that's a problem because we didn't require that not all of the ballots be pre-marked. So we'd like to propose putting in a minimum number of ballots that are hand-marked so that you do get that human element, that it is reading an actual human ballot. So we'd like to incorporate both, but we will set a standard for ourselves to, you know, create that minimum that we have to provide in a manually marked ballot.
Stephanie, this is Steve Freeman. Could I make an input on that?
Certainly.
I would like us to be careful not to create too rigid of a standard in terms of that, because it's been one of our experiences on the testing. There is strong value in not necessarily using a large number of unique ballots, but to be able to take ballots with identifiable differences that have been hand-marked and run them through multiple times. And the reason for that is that there is a class of problem that's associated with that, where the particularly in terms of the paper scanner ballots, which we're talking about, where a particular mark may be read one time and not read another. You can do several hundred ballots and not be able to verify and validate that particular problem, where if you take a smaller number of the ballots and run them through multiple times, if the system allows it, you can catch that problem a lot more efficiently and still represent some of the loading against the system using hand-marked ballots.
So, Steve, you would recommend kind of a combination of vendor-marked, hand-marked, and duplicately run ballots, if you will.
Yeah. Well, okay. On the vendor-marked ballots, what we would propose would be that Colorado specifies what the markings would be,
okay.
And it's the vendor has the ability to go ahead and able to mass-produce a number of ballots under those particular markings. On the hand-marked ballots, the vendor wouldn't necessarily be involved in it. Your staff, someone, volunteers, whatever it is, would mark a set of them, but we don't necessarily try to build a large number of different ballots. But we include the provision in it that we do a certain number of ballots, and then we go ahead and recycle and rerun those ballots multiple times to catch that problem in terms of intermittent There's a word for it, and for some reason it's escaping me at the current second. I can't think of it. it's statistical vision that goes on that the ballot isn't necessarily being read consistently from time to time. Okay. And that is a problem that needs to be documented and identified in the system when it's occurring. It's not necessarily a fatal problem. One of the vendors, for example, marginal marks, that's what they're referring to. One of the vendors makes a point of identifying the type of marks and can detect where they may be in that particular category and successfully go ahead and identify those particular ballots for a human review, which is one approach to being able to deal with that. So that the problem is not a difficult one. It's just a matter of making sure that we're including and considering and testing that within the testing. It also would significantly reduce the cost and effort of doing the testing if we didn't go for hundreds of hand-marked ballots, be able to use a smaller set to get the same effect.
Yeah, if I can comment, just for perspective again, Stephanie, there are, I mean, you run a lot of different tests, testing a voting system, testing a lot of different stuff. Some of those tests are designed to evaluate the system's ability to read the marks on the system, the quality with which it does that, the amount of that variation that the system has on reading marginal marks. Those are all concerns. Other things that you test are the ability of the system to accumulate numbers for a large number of ballots, the ability to handle splits. So you can very well pound a system and get a very good analysis of its ability to interpret hand-marked ballots properly in a set of tests designed for that, but in set of tests that are focusing on other requirements, it makes a lot of sense to use machine-marked ballots where then you don't have to deal with the errors in reading marks in determining if you've got the function to do whatever it is you're testing. And there are sometimes you want to subject the system to variations in human behavior and see how it responds, and there are times when you want to test the response of the system without introducing any extraneous errors.
Okay, thank you both.
Okay, here's how I divide up the time that remains in order to finish by 12:30. I have a number of people present who provided written comments, and I'd like to give them a chance to highlight the comments that we haven't covered so far. I also have about three people that have signed up to testify that didn't provide written comments, but I want to give them some time. So if I allow 20, well, I hate to, it's going to really cut it tight, 25 minutes for the folks who made written comments, Mesa, Jeffco, Common Cause, Harvey, and Al, 25 minutes, 5 minutes each, to highlight any remaining issues that you want us to make sure we understand from your written comments. And then that would leave 15 minutes, 5 minutes each for Mr. Moll, Russ Ragsdale, and Faith Gross. Is that okay with everybody? Not ideal, Russ? Okay, thank you. All right, thanks. And I don't know, Faith, how much I was only allowing you 5 minutes. I don't know whether that's five's okay. I'm going to assume five or so for Mr. Moll will also work as well. But so maybe we'll just start. I'll try to, I mean, as we go around the room, tell me if you know, maybe you don't need the 5 minutes or maybe you need a few minutes more, but we'll try to make this equitable and work through it. Let me start with Mesa. Sheila, do you have anything that you want to highlight from the remaining comments?
Well, I would just say that the work on Rule 45 that's been performed to date is definitely a step in the right direction. And for Mesa County, we're just very excited and glad to see the movement. I think Stephanie said earlier in this hearing that the state wants to get away with, or way, not away with, but I mean away from. Wow. Sorry. From what happened in 2007 and from previous certifications, and a lot of the testimony I had prepared really had to do with that. So I don't want to bring up past grievances, but just say I think that it's moving in the right direction, and I would like to stay supportive and continue to work with you guys to make this the best it can be.
Thank you, Sheila, and mm-hmm. thanks for the comments as well that you provided us.
Sheila, let me add. We have found it very useful, and this is for all of the various comments, to have draft language. That gives us the ability to try to put different ideas in front of us and try to figure out what is useful and what works. And we got a lot of draft language from not only Mesa County, but most of the folks that are willing to put their shoulder to the wheel in this tough work. And I just want to say to everyone, thank you for your patience and your suggestions and your draft language.
Jefferson County.
Thank you, Deputy Secretary Hobbs, Pam Anderson, Jefferson County. I would like to reiterate that sentiment that the draft process has been very useful and a big improvement in prior processes that we've undergone. And I just, the only additional comment that I would make to the, you know, to emphasize our written comments, and I don't know if it's appropriate, but to emphasize the current existing equipment in use in Colorado and under 1335, the grandfathering nature of that. I don't know if it's appropriate to emphasize that in the current certification rules, but it is silent right now in the rules, and whether or not that needs additional clarification or if the statute is sufficient. But I'd like to hear a little more from the Secretary's office, your position on that. And finally, I really look forward to moving forward, and I recognize the difficulty in balancing the technology of the systems, the real-world application of them, and the very swiftly moving or not so swiftly moving regulatory and technological development that exists in elections administration. So I appreciate all the work and effort by all the parties in spending time at looking at this, and just, you know, a little rah-rah for the counties. We are doing a little election right now, and so I appreciate all the election administrators' input at a time that's been, you know, a little tad busy.
Thank you, Pam. And I, by the way, I think I also want to leave a little bit of time right at the end. I'm going to carve out a little bit of time before 12:30 for Freeman Kraft McGregor, Stephanie, and the Secretary, and anybody else here who has anything that needs to be shared with the group. So let me go to the other side of the room, Common Cause. Anything you want to emphasize from your written comments?
I apologize. I may have missed some of the comments,
sorry.
So I apologize if I'm redundant.
Yeah, basically, if you 5 or so minutes, if you would like, if there's anything you want to emphasize from your comments.
First, I want to say thank you for this office and opening this process. I have never seen a process like this. I mean, we have a lot of task force, and we have a lot of opportunities to work with the Secretary of State and the County Clerk, certainly through legislative process and others, but I think this has been really sort of bold, and I really appreciate the opportunity to open up this conversation publicly before a formal process is undergone, so that you really can solicit feedback and we can discuss the real world impacts as a community. So I really value that and want to thank you for doing it. The other points that are in my comments I think are self-explanatory, so I'm just curious about, you know, what is appropriate expertise, and we sort of use some terminology, and just the opportunity for the rules is to be as clear as possible. So it's kind of drilling down what is the expectation there, and then to what extent does that expectation go? Is it within this office, to the control of the Secretary? How do we weigh in the factor that we're relying on other states? Are they going to be held to the same standards? So how do we evaluate what appropriate expertise is, not just with regards to this office, but the other states and testing labs, what have you, that we utilize? My other comment about sort of deviations and how we account for them, I sort of question this team note, if that's a sufficient process to really tell the story of why we've sort of allowed a system to go forward that has a deviation or that requires a modification. I think that, you know, again, in the spirit of transparency, we want to just be as open as possible as to why we're making the decisions that we make. And I know, I don't know if Faith has talked yet, but we know that the systems don't meet all of the needs that we have, whether it's for accessibility issues or security issues or, you know, important aspects of the system. So I think we just need to be very clear publicly about the decisions that we're making. And a team note sounds sort of minor. It just seemed something that required more of an elevated status. I think that those are the only ones I want to highlight. Thanks for the opportunity to be part of this.
Okay. Thank you, Jenny. Harvey?
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Hobbs. First of all, I also would like to appreciate this process. It's what I was thinking in 2006 when we were working on Rule 45 last time. I spent a long time rewriting Rule 45. I'm still working for that document because a lot of the things I wrote there are still, I still think are needed today. And I've only managed to go through about one-third of the current document. And the remaining two-thirds, I've been looking at my comments here, and they're still relevant. I hope that I may just send my 2006 or early 2007 document back to you to take a look, so you can take a look at those other comments on the remaining portions. I really want to make sure that what we're producing here is a really useful voting system, and that we manage to catch the problems with the voting system that actually are causing the most angst for our election officials. And I know this personally. I know that systems are passing through these tests that are causing problems for election officials. I'd rather that wasn't the case. We know that the legislature's grandfathered all the voting systems in use in 2008. That should be taking the pressure off the election officials who are looking for the next system down the line. They should be able to run their elections now with their existing equipment, and we should be able to take our time to certify equipment by a due process, and even if it, with a practical election test, even if it takes a couple of years, it can only help our election officials to run an election, or an excellent election, and we really should pay attention to that that possibility. The question is, are we going to be guiding the vendors in the development of technology or not? Colorado is a leading state on election policy, election use of technology, election methods. We need to think of ourselves as a leader in the nation in guiding where election technology is going to go. And I'm talking about auditing here primarily. There are technologies out there like single ballot auditing, which was just used in Aspen, Colorado. Access to cast vote records or the interpretation of each ballot. These provide incredible efficiency in terms of auditing and extra accuracy. We definitely need to put some kind of language into our Rule 45 to guide vendors to at least feel comfortable about adding those things to their equipment and know that in Colorado it will be appreciated. Also, access to election information. Because we've got computers running elections now, it's possible to provide information to the public, to have the image of the ballot available for auditing purpose and even for delivery to the public under appropriate conditions. These are things that we have to think about for the future and really ought to be now in Rule 45 for equipment that's going to be released 4 or 5 years from now. On the two rules which Stephanie just brought up, I definitely think both of them are very important to think about. One is about the machine marking or vendor marking of ballots. Vendor marking of ballots to me is an anathema. That is a mistake. You do not want the party being tested to be providing the test data for the test, period. I can't imagine an explanation for why you would go that way. As for machine marking of ballots, there is an explanation for machine marking ballots. partly Paul Kraft mentioned the possibility of needing huge numbers of ballots for scale of election scale testing of tabulation and so forth. Yes, that's true. We should have that. We should be able to test in the numbers of hundreds of thousands for some Colorado counties. When we have ballot marking devices, and I am anticipating we will have ballot marking devices in Colorado at some point, it would obviously be necessary to test the tabulation systems with machine-marked ballots. That is a machine-marked ballot. But prior to that, and only to the extent that those ballot marking devices are in use in real elections, should we be using machine-marked ballots for any kind of voter intent or interpretation testing. And it's very important to make sure we do good voter interpretation testing, including the use of unusual materials. Because we have a mail ballot election in approaching or passing 50% of our votes now, it's essential to be prepared for uncontrolled marking of the ballots, different colors of pen, different thicknesses, pens that can go through to the other side of the paper, and the mayonnaise, ketchup, and so forth. We've heard about it. The Secretary of State's office did use that kind of testing in 2007. That was a good idea. I am not against that. Do not want to see that done away with. That's very important to do testing on paper ballots in large numbers using real live conditions. And also, in fact, I'm proposing again to have an actual practical test with an actual election. On the topic of the county clerk and recorders being present at the testing and the vendors touching the equipment, I agree vendors touching the equipment does not sound good. But for the same reason, county clerk and recorders in the room has a problem with it. And the problem is the likelihood that extreme expertise is going to be available during the time of the test, which is going to obscure procedural problems with the equipment when it actually goes out into the field in your average county. And we don't want that to happen. The only way I can think of to solve that problem is to actually certify the operators of voting equipment so that they are up to speed at the same level as those county clerk and recorder office representatives who are present at the testing, or for that matter, the vendors' representatives who are present at the testing, if in fact they are solving problems which will allow the system to pass the test, which information may not be available to your average county clerk in an average county. So I am suggesting that were the test to be done in a manner in which the experts are running the test, that we should make sure that experts are always available whenever those machines are being used. And we need a whole infrastructure for training people to operate the equipment. And I would point out that that doesn't sound like the citizens' election. I don't actually like that route. I prefer the route that the voting equipment can be used by election judges who are coming from the general, not very technically trained population. And as a matter of fact, our county clerks and recorders being elected don't go through any technical qualification, even as much as a sheriff does to be qualified to run. And perhaps that's another thing that we should be looking at, but we shouldn't assume that all our county clerks and recorders are ready to handle equipment that's been tested under the conditions of experts operating and pointing out all the workarounds. And there are workarounds for most of these problems. And I know the problems that come up in elections are, to a small extent, to some extent, and mostly to a theoretical extent, security issues. But the practical, functional, actual problems of running the election, the sunlight that shines on the paper out detector on the heart system and prevents it from the whole DRE from functioning, those kinds of things, they need to be known by all election officials. They need to be found during testing. And we don't want to have the test experts say, oh, yeah, well, if you just move the thing out of the sunlight, it will work, unless everybody who's running an election system knows that. And there's a vast amount of information out there that our election officials don't know. One of them knows. Somewhere, somebody may know, in some county, with some condition, but we're not sharing that information. We need to have a way to share it, and the certification test is the best remedy to avoid that problem in the first place and not try to correct it after the fact. Thanks.
Thank you, Harvey. Al?
Secretary Bushert, thank you for making an effort to make this an open process in the drafting of this rule. I'm pleased to see the willingness to do this. I'm, on the other hand, disappointed that Colorado Voter Group's efforts, which are only partially indicated here, didn't make it to the agenda as items to be discussed. And 5 minutes, of course, isn't going to do much of a dent here. It's difficult to try to cover the terrain quickly, but let me try to reach over and contrast law and engineering a little bit. In law, as I understand it, or as I've observed, people are looking at the statutes or the contracts or whatever it is, the documents, and they're also looking at the cases, and they're trying to persuade a judge or somebody to interpret the contract or the document. In engineering, the rules are a little tougher than that, and an illustration of nuts and bolts might serve my purpose. If I'm going to do a project, and I know I'm going to need nuts and bolts, it is totally inadequate for me to say, go get me some nuts and bolts. I mean, you can very easily imagine somebody coming in with tiny little bolts and huge nuts that don't go together. Or in the case of an airplane, the requirement for weight may have a lot of impact, whereas in a structural project, torque may have a very high impact. The requirements are very precise, and in engineering, we are required to write down exactly what we want, like not just a bolt that's 2 inches long, but that it has this sort of a thread in it, exactly, and so on. And we also are required to say, for everything that we order, what's an acceptable variation? So if I say I need a 2-inch bolt, plus or minus 1/10 of an inch, and the reason I do that is that somebody may have a machine that can make 2.5-inch bolts and produce them very cheaply and send them to us, except that the bolt is used in an application where there isn't 2 and 2.5 inches of space to put it in. So what I'm getting at is that in engineering, the requirements are much more tight than they are in law. And the determination of whether or not you've complied with the requirements is more black and white than it is in law. Now, this rule has not achieved an engineering level of standard that I demonstrated with my nuts and bolts story. It neither says exactly what is supposed to be there, it does not say what the tolerance is if it's not, and it doesn't provide, in fact, any way to measure whether or not it's here. So that's my first point. I think the rules should incorporate that. Second, the rule is supposed to be addressing the voting system, and it focuses on counting ballots. And as we all in this room know, there's more to a voting system than counting the ballots. You could have a paper ballot counting system that was absolutely bulletproof, perfect, never had a problem, ever. And yet it doesn't work as a part of a system because it doesn't tell you that only half of the ballots were counted. In other words, it can perfectly count whatever you tell it, but it doesn't tell you that you're missing half. A system for a voting system has to be able to detect all of the minutiae associated with running the election. In the case of, let's say, canvassing, for example, this rule does not address canvassing. The rule says that it's supposed to address canvassing because that's one of the elements required to produce an election. I've been on the canvas board many times, and I can tell you nightmarish stories about what's wrong with canvassing and why I'm so passionate about getting it correctly covered in the rule, to make sure that we are able to conduct a canvass in every jurisdiction in Colorado. Right now, that's not possible. Firstly, the data that would be required to meet my needs as a canvasser is in some way either unavailable or proprietary. Now, can you imagine that? I'm to certify the election result, and I can't get the data. So canvassing has to be incorporated here. And I'll tick off a couple of other quick things that need to be incorporated that are already in the what's envisioned here but are not covered in the details. The exporting of election data. The mail ballot process. Mail-in ballots, as you may know, represent an enormous threat to the election result. That isn't even addressed in any detail associated with this rule. Acceptance testing. There's a token paragraph in 45.11 saying it's supposed to happen. There's no verification that it did, and I can tell you it did not. And there's no criteria or standard for determining what is it, even if you wanted to do it. The archive of materials that is required by law, I can tell you that in my experience, the archive of materials is a joke. Nobody has a list of what's supposed to be archived. Nobody verifies whether the stuff was archived. And when you go back to look, I guess you're not supposed to be surprised that the materials aren't there. But the election system requires the archiving of the material. The auditing, the audit process needs to be, standards need to be set for the auditing process. And this rule does not do so. I'm eating into your time. I have a couple of other points. But the main point of what I just said is that we must discuss and come to an agreement of what is required to conduct an election. And this rule requires that that include all of the elements, and the implementation details of this rule do not follow its own instruction. Finally, this entire election process must be made openly verifiable. Now, people obfuscate privacy, security, we don't want to show you, it's proprietary information. They throw up walls when the public wants to actually verify an election. What does it mean to verify an election? It does not mean to make sure that the votes that got put into the final spreadsheet got correctly tabulated. What it does mean is that every effort on the part of an eligible elector resulted in a transaction into the system, and every transaction is fully accounted for. And every attempt at a transaction by an ineligible elector does not make it into the system. So, sum it up. I don't know how to begin by changing a word here and a word there to implement the kind of standards that are required, the kind of coverage for what's required in an election system, and the opening up of the system to where we're proud as an election organization to show anybody, you find a problem and I'll kill it, you know? Right now it's you can't look. Trust us. And that's not good enough. And I thank you for your time.
Thank you. Hillary Hall, you did provide written comments, and I overlooked you, and I apologize. If you'd like to provide some comments, moral comments now, that would be very welcome.
I'll be brief, just that we...
Sorry.
We're broadcasting.
Most of our comments were directed at the test plan itself and how that the criteria for how those that will be conducted and the fact that there's not a lot of detail in rule, either defining a process for how the test plan is developed without, I mean, part of it is allowing for flexibility, which we like because it addresses the needs of the vendors, what other testing has already been done. But there does need to be some minimum criteria of what is included in a test plan. I think some of that also would address the timeline issues that could be part of the test plan once you know what information you have and what information you're looking for. And as important as to what you are testing for is how are you going to test for that. We'd also like to see detail on that. We, as you know, have done did quite a bit of testing over the summer, and some of the pieces that are essential in seeing the accuracy and security of equipment is creating as close to an election process as is possible, including putting ballots, folding them, putting them through the postal system, even, I mean, you don't have to actually mail them, going down, running them through the machines, and seeing what impact that has on the equipment and how that impacts your processes. The other piece that we feel is really important is around the printing of ballots and when you use a pre-printed, pre-marked test deck and what it is that you're testing for, as well as when do you use ballots that are marked by hand. And while it is more difficult, and we know, especially with the LAT, that that's where a majority of your errors come up, because getting the human being to mark the ballot the way that you've asked them to mark it, and it's a problem. But a hand-marked ballot is very different from a machine-marked ballot that's marked the same every time. And so somehow that has to be addressed in the testing of what it is you're testing for and when it's important to have that hand-marked ballot. So we feel that that's an important part that needs to be included in, and not quite sure where that fits in, which is why we didn't tie anything to a specific rule. The other piece is to create as close to an election setting as possible. And one of the pieces that we know was really missing from last time, it's important, was what pre and post processes also impact how a ballot is handled. I mean, ballots were put through the system that were not, that we would never put through a system. It's important to know what happens when it goes through the system, but it's also important as part of the certification to recognize that under normal conditions, that ballot wouldn't go through the system, and here's why it's important for it to not go through the system. So to balance and broaden the picture a bit. And with that, it is important to have people who know how to use the equipment involved in an appropriate manner of testing that use it in election settings, because it is very different when you're actually processing an election versus you're doing a test and you have lots of time to figure things out, and you also have lots of time to ask, I'm trying to think how to say this politely. I'll just leave it at that. It's important to involve the election officials in this in some manner that is also still transparent and meets the goals. It's not to make the system work in ways that it wouldn't normally work, but to also use it as it's designed with an understanding. So, thank you,
Hillary. Faith Gross, I think I'll call on you next. You know, you have the same problem. We need to get you to a microphone, if you don't mind moving to a place where somebody will give up their seat. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, I'm Faith Gross with the Legal Center for People with Disabilities and Older People, and the, I guess, authorized representative of the disability community in Colorado. And I should explain that I did not submit written requests because while I am recognized as an expert on accessible voting, the technology aspects of accessible voting are beyond my area of expertise, and the person that I needed to consult with, our work schedules last week were in conflict. In fact, she was in Washington participating in the EAC Accessibility Roundtable, and that is Dr. Diane Golden. Some of you may be familiar with Dr. Golden. So that said, I do have a few comments. first is, it seems to me that what makes the most sense is to have all of the accessibility requirements in one rule instead of in at least two rules, and that should be Rule 35. Thank you. At a very minimum, the accessibility requirements should mirror the 2005 VBSG accessibility requirements. However, that said, the disability community as a whole has had some issues with the 2005 requirements for accessibility. Usability has, as we've used some of the equipment, usability has risen as a problem. Last year in Jefferson County, one voter reported to me that it took her 45 minutes to navigate through the ballot. This is a blind voter who is very tech savvy, somebody who uses technology daily in her life, and yet it still took her 45 minutes to get through the ballot, which I don't think is an acceptable amount of time. She was allowed to do that, and that's great, but it shouldn't take 45 minutes. So usability is something that I would like to see us consider as well. On some of the specific questions in the rules, the issue of the shape and color of buttons, it's my understanding, and this is one of the areas I need to consult, but it's my understanding that that is in the existing VBSG for a reason. I know that some individuals who are blind due to diabetes and may, as a result of their diabetes, also have problems with feeling in their fingers. And so the different shape of the buttons and the size and the color, and also individuals with low vision may not be able to distinguish text but can tell colors. And so there are reasons. I understand that from the vendor's perspective that is limiting for them, but I do believe that that's a technology problem that can be solved. So my recommendation would be to maintain the shape and color requirements. Regarding having more than one port in a system, I think it's important to have at a minimum two ports to plug in devices. An individual may need to have audio access and sip and puff access. Regarding sip and puff, individuals are going to bring their own sip and puff device. We do not want people to be sharing sip and puff devices. Right now, we've got the flu season, and everybody's very paranoid. It would not be safe, really, to share sip and puff devices. So there should be that ability to bring your own device, whatever it is that you need. And then one of my favorite topics, the voter verifiable paper audit trail. In Rule 45.5.2.9.10, it has, it says that, uses the words as possible, that the voter be able to independently verify what's on their paper ballot or the paper audit trail or paper audit record. Under the current systems, what the voter is verifying is what they've sent to the printer, not what's actually been printed on the paper. This is a huge issue in the disability community. In Colorado, we have in statute that paper audit record could become the official ballot of record. And so that voter who is unable to verify what is on the paper does not have equal access and does not have the same ability as sighted voters or other voters without disabilities to verify what is actually written on that paper record. And that is a significant problem. So let me see if I have anything else. Oh, ballot marking devices. Since that seems to be the direction that we are headed in Colorado, I would like to see in the rules something very specific to ballot marking devices. The current ballot marking device on the market that we're most familiar with, the AutoMark, does not allow the voter to verify any write-in candidate or any write-in vote that they are trying to cast. All it says to the voter is write-in. So you have no way of knowing if you have accurately entered the name of the person that you're trying to vote for. So that needs to be addressed. And I think there should be a better solution to addressing the independent casting of a ballot. We addressed it a couple years ago through statute language that says that in a polling place where ballot marking devices are used, every voter will have their ballot placed in the ballot box by an election judge. Frankly, I never expected that that was going to pass, but it did. So we have that in statute. I think it might be very difficult to actually implement. And what I would like to see is the ballot marking devices somehow have the function of allowing that voter to independently cast their ballot. So I will, as we move through the process, I will submit written comments, but I need to get some higher level technical assistance. And finally, I just want to echo everybody's compliment on the process. I think it's been outstanding and really appreciate the opportunity. Thank you.
Thank you, Faith. Mr. Mole, do you wish to comment? See, you're still here? Oh, okay. Okay. I don't have anybody else signed up, I don't think. So I would like to give Paul or Steve or Kate an opportunity if they have any other comments. They've had the benefit of having those comments and digesting them, and they've just heard some more comments. And so if you guys want to take a few minutes, 3 minutes or so, if you have anything to add, go ahead. Paul, are you still there?
Yes, I was muted, sorry. prior to the last speaker, I was a little concerned that we really had not had what I thought was adequate input from the disability community on their wants and needs for the rule. With the accessibility section, we basically removed sections that we felt conflicted with the intent of Rule 35 and of the statutes. And then we left in things in Rule 45 that were requirements that were not in Rule 35, assuming once again that there had been a process on the prior rule and that some decision had been made to include those requirements. Some of the requirements there are going to be fail point for some of current systems. We would also agree with the prior speaker that, yes, usability is the big issue. I think the voting system industry and election administrators have done at least an adequate job of providing accessibility, but the problem with all this equipment now, accessible devices, comes down to usability, and that's where there's a tremendous amount of work to be done yet. That is one of the areas that NIST has been working on for the last couple of years, and it's a difficult issue. But usability for both voters with disabilities and those without remains a high priority issue. It's important, though, as I said with system development earlier, to remember that you cannot produce new art in the voting system world by regulation. Ultimately, the new art is going to be produced to meet the needs of those who are writing the checks. Probably, I guess my highest recommendation, and Steve and Kate may disagree with this, would be a twofold approach. One, to make sure that Colorado disabled voters are getting the best of current technology that's available, and it's being delivered to work as well as it can and being properly used. And then perhaps another initiative to fund development of custom devices to fund some research and development to do something on another front to get some new stuff. So I will leave it at that and leave the rest of the time for Steve and Kate.
I guess that puts my call on. This is Steve. I do believe a number of things that Paul was saying. I wanted to mention one item, and I'm concerned within the terms of the way that these rules are getting written and changed, because I think it may be a source of a lot of the problems and issues. It's really easy to establish a requirement for some sort of objective or goal in a piece of legislation or administrative rule. It's another issue at all together to try to define that so it becomes testable in an objective fashion. And one of the things that we need to be paying close attention to on a number of these, I think it's actually at the heart of a lot of the comments, was we have a statement saying that something's going to be done, but there is nothing in there to say how it's going to be done, and more to the point, how it's going to be done in a reliable fashion. There's a process that the Federal Testing Agency is trying to deal with in terms of the qualification of the test labs, what's called standard methods development and validation. This has proven to be a very difficult problem for NIST, who's probably one of the nation's leaders in trying to do this type of thing, to try to come up with on terms of the election systems. And we face some of the same issues in terms of the state. I would like to see us try to build towards the idea that we establish a requirement, we establish some metrics or requirements for that, and that we try to establish a particular method in terms of how the testing is going to be done. That does not mean, or it should not mean, because I don't think that Colorado can afford to be in the development stage on that we develop all new methods. There's a number of methods that may be out there in the industry that can be quoted in reference to assist with the testing, add a lot of transparency to testing. However, there actually is a shortage of methods applying to election systems, which is where one of our challenges are. I can think of several places where we have some background that we can see some potentials for some methods that could be applied to some of these problems, and that may be a direction that we need to be going in is try to document some of that. I'm not sure Paul will agree to the level of work that's going to have to go into ball with that, though. It's not something that will happen overnight.
Okay, well, thank you. Stephanie, do you have anything further?
First of all, I'd like to thank everybody that submitted written comments. Those were very beneficial to us in identifying where there are problems, where there are items that we still needed to address. So I truly appreciate the effort. And I know for those counties that submitted comments, this is leading up to an election. So I appreciate the comments, and I appreciate your attendance here. A couple quick things. One, Harvey, you mentioned auditing. You know, under House Bill 1335, we are required to implement a new auditing procedure, which does pose some problems with the current systems, but hopefully we'll see some improvements as we implement this audit and the next generation of systems that are purchased in the state. There were some comments about ballot marking devices. That is kind of the shift, and as we look at the shift toward paper ballot systems, and we do have applications for certification that contain ballot marking devices at the moment that will be a part of this new rule, a new testing process. I would like to follow up on, you know, the comment that a lot of the clerks lack the expertise to work this equipment. I don't disagree with that. Most of those clerks are understanding of that, and they do have expertise on hand on election day. A lot of the vendors will actually pay the vendors to be on site on election day to help with that. Although I do appreciate that we need to look at that and consider the usability from start to finish of both the elected officials and the voting public. Other than that, I think I'm just very pleased with the input we received, and I appreciate it.
Thank you, and I'll give the Secretary a chance to provide any closing remarks, but I want to talk just briefly about maybe where we go from here. we have a lot of work to do. I mean, I think that's part of what this illustrates, is we got a lot of good information, a lot of good comments, a lot of good questions. An awful lot of work still needs to go into rules, the proposed rules, I think even before we issue a formal notice of rulemaking. And there is a quirk of the State Administrative Procedures Act that you're basically on a kind of this month-to-month basis. If you don't issue a notice of rulemaking by the end of any calendar month, then it slips another month before you can adopt rules, to make a long story short. So ideally, it would be nice to issue a notice of rulemaking by the end of this month. I don't know that that's possible. Obviously, when we do issue a notice of rulemaking, that's not the end of the process, as everybody's familiar. We still take public comments. We still can take suggested language. But it does hamstring us because it has to be a formal process. We can't have informal discussions. All of the comments have to be on the record, either orally or through written submission. So it really hampers discussion. And so I'm just not sure we're ready to do that, that we can incorporate everything we've heard and feel very comfortable in the next 10 days or so. But that's something we'll talk about. But I think it's a testament to how valuable the input is that we have, that it's clear that we have so many things to think about and so much work to do. So that's, in the meantime, if until we issue notice of rulemaking, well, even after that, I think people can still submit comments, suggestions. They'll either inform us as we draft the next version to be proposed, or we'll make it part of the formal rulemaking record. Either way, it'll be helpful. That's where I think we're headed next. Faith?
So are you saying that we can still submit written comments?
Yes.
If I may. Second. Yeah, if you still have comments or even comments that have come out of this hearing, please feel free to submit them. Our point in having that cutoff was so that we could be prepared to address those items today. That doesn't preclude us from, or you know, you and I getting together and discussing comments that you have, or anyone else. So yes, you may. You're welcome.
Thank you, Al.
So we understand, can you give us any inkling at all what you intend to do with the Colorado Voter Group submission of October 14?
I don't know that we can. You know, Al, you said cancel Rule 45. You know, I think we're working on trying to draft amendments to Rule 45 and Rule 37. I mean, we did get comments, and Hillary Hall provided written comments that we didn't put on the sheet as well, because they didn't lend themselves to specific amendments to the rules. But we take them under advisement. You know, because we haven't talked about them in terms of amendments to the rules doesn't mean we're not listening. So we will.
I understand correctly. You're not going to pursue the October 14th. Submission further?
Not sure I know what you mean, Al. You didn't provide comments about the amended rules. You provided comments, unless I'm missing something. You said cancel Rule 45.
You said redo the
rulemaking process. You said terminate the voting equipment certification manager. I'm not sure what you're referring to.
Maybe I didn't underline the word draft. It says cancel the draft Rule 45, not Rule 45.
How does that help us? That's what I'm at a loss. What do we do with a comment like that, to be blunt?
Well, it goes on to say quite a bit.
Okay. To the extent that you had some constructive things to say, we've looked at all of the comments, whether or not they made their way onto the spreadsheet.
I don't see that they have been actualized, and I get the gist that.
But we haven't done
for,
another draft yet. Right. We haven't incorporated any of these comments.
I'm just trying to understand, as I did at the last public meeting, understand whether we are wasting our efforts by not conforming to some magic that gets us on the list. You know, and I'm beginning to sense that the only thing that you accept is alternate language to what's already there. And as you can tell with the reading of what we've offered, that we're more concerned about what's not there than perfecting what is there.
Okay, well, fair comment. Some people make comments about concepts without actual language, and we've reviewed that and we'll continue to do that. And if you have, you know, any specific suggestions about the amendments to the rules, we'd be happy to have that. Mr. Secretary, do you have any further comments?
Just a comment that kind of ties some of these things together. What we are doing here is adopting a rule concerning voting system standards for certification. That's the title of Rule 45. We are obligated to do that under both the Constitution and the statute 1335 passed last year. So we're going to continue to work through this, and whether or not we start the formal rulemaking next month or the month after, we need to have more time to figure out how to take all these comments in. I think it is fair to note that there are other sections of the rules that need work. But you eat an elephant one bite at a time, and the most pressing and most important right now is to get Rule 45 into much better shape. I've mentioned to a number of folks, at some point and at some time, rewriting Title I needs to be done because there are inconsistencies and problems in the whole title. But that needs to be studied carefully and planned carefully and not done without adequate preparation. So let's continue working on this project of getting Rule 45 done in the best way that we can so that we can go forward with the certification process and make that process as good as possible. I join everyone else's comments in thanking all of you folks for spending a whole morning with us and helping us do this process. Thank you.
Thanks, everybody. Appreciate it.